Big Daddy Dog Numero Uno. Number one.
At number one is a band whose lead singer is a cheerleader for rock. Brent Smith of Shinedown says rock and roll isn't a genre of music, it's a way of life. People who say rock is dying, well, they're wrong. It's not going anywhere. And neither is Shinedown. They're resting comfortably at the top of the chart for the sixth straight week in a row with Unity.
Shinedown. It's been number one for 6 weeks now. That's it for us. I'm Nikki Sixx. If you missed any part of our chart, get caught up at the SideshowCountdown.com.
It also has all the information you need for this summer's Motley Kiss Tour. I'm Carrie Kasem.
And we'll see you on the road.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Jalene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jalene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. And when Mr. Announcer said Peter and Jalene will be giving their opinions,
yes.
What's the little cliche? No doubt.
No doubt about it.
Yeah. Hi, Jalene. How are you?
Great.
Welcome, everyone. You know, actually, we are told in broadcast school never to have those broad greetings. You're never supposed to. You're supposed to be talking one on one. So I am talking right to you.
There you go. Yeah, that's right. Exactly what you're supposed to do.
Thank you for joining me. Not yes. Everybody.
Just you.
Just you. Everyone
you?
Else is now.
And
you know,
me.
Just kind of there on the sidelines. But it's you and me and Jalene.
Yes. Right. Yes.
And Sarah.
And Sarah.
Who's taking our calls at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
If you would like to email us, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. If you give us some, you know, short ones rather than a manifesto. I'll read the manifestos tomorrow or sometimes. Wasn't I talking about that on the air?
Yeah.
Like I answered somebody from March.
I know.
Yeah.
That's very unlike you, though.
I know. It's long. We get lots of email.
Yeah, we do.
We have a Facebook page, which we'd like you to be part of. It's facebook.com/nightcall. A lot of activity going on there, and you can see what is happening. Jalene posted some. Did that all come out?
Pictures.
Yeah, I know. The photographs of Jillian and I, we were at a business meeting about a concert coming up, which we will tell you about in a couple of weeks.
And you'll think we're the 1% when you see it, because
yeah.
We actually drank champagne.
But no, who would know? They might have thought we were drinking beer. I don't know why you said it was a champagne glass.
It looks like a glass of champagne, and there's a bottle of champagne next to it.
Well, there you go.
We're
you
closer,
go.
Peter.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, my sister, who's alike, what is the designation of? Because they're not friends on a page like that. You're alike.
She's a fan. Fan.
So I wrote her and said, these are just photographs that Jalene puts there because she looks so good, and I'm just a prop.
I know. You look great in those pictures.
Yeah. Well, my sister said you're a very handsome prop.
You are a handsome prop.
I didn't think so.
No, I thought they were good.
Yeah, come on.
There's one that I posted that it was just plain funny because our friend wasn't real familiar with my phone, and so he was just kind of doing these random shots, and it's me just chawing your ear off. I said, poor Peter, what am I going on about this time?
Hey, if you missed any of this, or you'd like to hear it again, or hear sections you missed, or tell people about it, we'll have a podcast up on Monday. And by the way, Labor Day, although it should be May 1st, Labor Day in the United States is coming up next weekend. A lot of good things happening. You're going to be broadcasting live from Eats, Beats, and Eats.
Arts, Beats, and Eats.
Or in Open Carry. Yeah,
where that one D-bag with the open carry would probably be standing on the corner again, and I'll give him the stink eye again.
Careful.
And
really. Also the Detroit Jazz Festival, which is just incredible this year.
Sure, downtown.
Yeah,
right?
Downtown. Yeah, so lots of things going on, but not us, so we won't be there. But please join us. Lots of things going on.
We won't be here.
We won't be here. We'll be there.
We'll be there. We won't be here.
Yeah, we'll be listening to like Sonny Rollins or Jill Jack, who I just ran into
in
the post
artist.
Office. Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, so you're going to have to soak in the information tonight.
Yeah. Actually, if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and you go to the pod, or you, well, yeah, there's a little thing on the left that says podcast, and you can go to all the ones back, you know. Sometimes it's about current events, but if you'd like to hear some over or haven't or miss some, go to it.
And you can also, another good resource is WhiteRoseSociety.org.
Yeah.
And Ben, who runs that, has been archiving us for like 14 years at least.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Or right around there. So you can listen to early Pete and Jules.
Yeah. And so Tampa, Florida, home of death metal.
What?
Oh, yeah. But they're not going to be playing it at the Republican convention. Actually, I didn't realize that. Bands like Deicide and Obituary and Cannibal Corpse and groups like that, they came out of Tampa. That's what they're known for.
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of musicians out of Tampa, which I just find odd. But
apparently, the Republicans are not going to hear a note of it. Tampa gave the world death metal, a boundary-pushing style of heavy rock that features lyrics that can be decidedly anti-Christian. Some say it's ironic that a party that includes large numbers of religious conservatives would hold its convention in the city that fostered a music genre known for album titles like To Hell with God and Butchered at Birth.
Wow.
And Steve Huey, a critic at AllMusic.com, said it's kind of like having a group called Abstinence for Sexually Anxious holding its convention in San Francisco. Or a group called the Society for Hatred of Corn deciding to meet up in Iowa.
Oh, my home state.
That's right.
The corn state.
Yeah.
That's
so that's
great.
Happening. You know, right after 9/11, these very awful Christian preachers, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, got together and they decided that the reason that that we were hit by these terrorists on 9/11 wasn't because of this complete collapse of the security apparatus of the Bush administration, though they were warned.
Or the fact that half of the Middle East is PO'd at what we've done.
Right, or that was the second thing, yeah. Rather, it was lesbians and the ACLU and all that. So
these
this is
guys.
Right. So their idea, and I actually have an interview called, what was the name of the book? What?
Your headphones.
They're shrieking?
Yes.
That's okay. I don't care.
It's not pleasant to listen to, Peter.
Okay.
It's bad radio.
So anyway, I know the name of the book, the author that I'm interviewing at 1 a.m. is called Sex and Punishment. So this stuff goes, you know, way back. And these same guys.
Sexual repression.
Like they had Christian senators in the Roman Senate in the 4th century.
Really?
Yeah. A.D. So wait a minute, that shrieking thing
It set me off too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll have to let that.
Well, we were talking about 9/11 and Robert.
Yeah, yeah, right. So the idea of a lot of these early Christians, particularly and picked up by these so-called modern ones, is that the wrath of God will come down on societies that aren't religious enough.
Yeah.
And that's why we suffered 9/11, according to their nutty little deal.
That's just completely insane.
Yeah. So, but what does this say?
People are nuts.
What does this say about the hurricane coming to Tampa?
Well, what does it say? I mean, there's a lot of joking around going about that.
Yeah. So is that the wrath of God?
Yeah.
That's Hurricane Isaac. Apparently it's going to miss Tampa directly, but...
I heard something about it heading toward New Orleans that cannot happen.
And there's Hurricane Achan as well. Oh, my. Achan, but...
Oh, my. I lived down there, as you well know, Peter, and I went through 3 hurricanes, and it is a... I mean, it's just a craziness. People running around finding ice and generators and batteries and
kind of like here on July 4th when we lost power.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. But if you're wondering, Hurricane Achan. I thought we were up to the I, but that is Representative Todd Achan, A-K-I-N. Yeah, who is the
he's the guy,
the Republican standard bearer for the Senate in Missouri against Democratic incumbent Claire McCaskill.
But mostly the who said
that was talking about legitimate rape,
and that it doesn't result in or that
you don't get pregnant for legitimate rape.
Yeah, this guy.
I mean, there's a lot of women.
My God.
But what was so just horrible, on Monday, a poll came out saying that this Representative Achan, even after all of this, even after everybody in the Republican Party told him to quit, that he was a disgrace and stupid and, you know, that made no sense whatsoever, he was still leading in the polls.
I just will never understand this.
Here's the good news.
Hatred.
Now, 30% of independents have moved to the Democratic candidate to reelect Senator McCaskill. But, you know, the Republicans, of course, they're just steadfast. They didn't move a bit.
Yeah.
Well, imagine this. I had an accidental conference call with a friend in Fort Lauderdale and another one in Singapore.
What?
I need to do that all over, you know, Skype.
Who has that?
Yeah, I got butt called.
You did?
Yeah.
On Skype?
On Skype, yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, all of a sudden, they're saying, what are you doing here? And I said, yeah, the phone rang, you know. But anyway.
Weird.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, I'm having, this is...
So what about it?
I don't know. I can't remember.
Peter, God, you're losing it.
I know.
Come back to me.
I told him.
Come back to me, Peter.
I told him I was going to have a shocking announcement.
Tonight?
Tonight. And they said, what? And I said, now, this is called a teaser in the business.
You have to listen.
Yeah. In fact, why don't I say this? I'm going to have a shocking announcement at 11:15 Eastern time. That's in 6 minutes.
I don't like surprises.
5 minutes.
It better not be.
Well, that I'm leaving or
something? It better not be.
I got an offer in New York City.
Yeah, right. You would never go.
This is what it's beginning to lead up to my shocking announcement.
Okay.
And actually, a lot of people won't think it's shocking. My friends will think it's shocking.
Really?
That's all. Yeah.
Okay.
Other people probably think, well, that makes plenty of sense.
Will I find it shocking?
No.
No?
Or maybe. It's surprising, but not shocking. Okay. Can we move on? We can decide in
four and a half minutes.
Yeah. One of the things that I've been using a phrase, and I usually preface it by saying that we don't get too far by calling each other names,
true,
political names, although we do it.
We do it all the time.
We used to call them a-holes and nut jobs and teabaggers and stuff like psychos and
teabags.
I mean, but, you know, there is a certain precision in language that you can defend. Right?
Sure.
So I would do that. But the other thing is, and this is a very serious charge and one that I do try to use with absolute precision, and that is not an insult or what I would, you know, hyperbole or an exaggeration, and that is a lot of what is driving the Romney and Ryan campaign is what I call fascist hysteria. This is a psychological state of people that have themselves worked up so badly about Obama that it's not that his policies are wrong or that they were weak or that they are misguided, but somehow they are the product of a man that is a complete outsider. That there's a secret agenda. Mm-hmm. That he's not an American. That he's not
there's the whole black thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know,
racist.
Yeah. That's just an added component. And, of course, within fascist hysteria, it always has a large component of racism. They got to hate somebody, right?
Yeah.
And those are the people that are really at the core of it. Well, here's...
You know, I actually feel kind of sorry for those people. Sometimes.
Well, I always try to use the word almost.
Almost.
Before that. Because, yeah. I mean, they have a lot of problems, they can't face them, so they got to project them out onto others.
It's sad.
Yeah, I know. But they're making their problems other people's problems.
True.
That's where it all falls down.
Sure.
Hank Williams Jr. told a crowd at the Iowa State Fair a couple of days ago that he said about Obama, we've got a Muslim president who hates farming, hates the military, hates the U.S., and we hate him.
First of all, he doesn't hate the military. He's kept that sucker going on like crazy.
No cuts.
The farming thing. I don't get.
Hates the U.S. What's
hates
the evidence?
The
What's
what,
the problem?
He ran for president. He ran to be the boss of this country. I don't know about hating the U.S.
And you would think that someone would say, well, what are your proofs in this suggestion that the man has? But like I say, that the hysterical outbursts that resonates with people. I mean, in other words, it works with, you would think that someone would say that at anywhere, and that jaws would drop, people would
flood. Are you kidding?
Yeah, is this performer having a psychotic break right in front of us?
Yeah, right.
But if someone who had a psychotic break a long time ago, that's the Motor City Madman. Now it makes a lot more sense. Ted Nugent. He said the choice between President Obama and Republican nominee Mitt
There's Romney. There's a new one. don't want to call him by his name.
Yeah, Mitt Romney, Mitt Happens, was a blatant as a choice between good and evil. Here's what he told the New Times Broward, Palm Beach, Florida, when they were talking about what bands would represent Obama and Romney. The Romney-supporting rockers said, out-and-out politicians are anathema to rock and roll, so I hesitate to attempt to connect the two.
They're a what?
Anathema. I mean, you know, it's bad.
Oh.
Yeah, a lot of big words either mean bad or good.
Nugent can use big words?
Yeah, well, I read it somewhere. But on important issues, I'm saddened to admit that Obama represents everything bad about humanity and Romney pretty much all that is good. It is that stark. he says.
Well,
he says, if you can't go home and get everybody in your lives to clean house in this vile, evil, America-hating administration, I don't even know what you're made of. And again, you can say...
He's the hater.
Yeah, he is. But you can say that the Obama policies, you know, could argue, are going to be destructive economically, whereas, you know, I mean, you can make that argument.
Because he, you know, the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, he continued those, and we could go through a whole list of things. Right.
But here, so let's keep that in front of our minds, this idea of fascist hysteria.
Okay.
In 1936, in Spain, there was a revolt of the military against a liberal government that had been elected by the people. The military came in from Africa, from the Spanish possessions there, and it was led by this fascist general named Francisco Franco.
Mm-hmm.
And they imposed a fascist regime on Spain that was extraordinarily brutal, that began, and there was a civil war that lasted for 3 years, wound up killing on both sides like 1 million people. I mean, it was
involved in that.
We know somebody that fought in it when he was 16 on the good side.
Yeah, still with us.
That was good and evil then. Yeah. I mean, because fascism, I hope everybody admits, is evil.
Yeah.
But there's a book out called The Spanish Holocaust, Inquisition and Extermination in 20th Century Spain by Paul Preston. And I was reading a review of it in The Guardian of London online. And the reviewer says, Preston sees two main drivers behind the slaughter. The first was the absolute and often paranoid conviction of radical rightists that the enemy was evil. Democrats, communists, Jews, Freemasons, Marxists, Muslims, free women, trade unionists, socialists, socially concerned priests, and social liberals were, simply because of their beliefs, considered to be guilty of crimes against the fatherland. God, the fatherland, God, and the natural social order. Now, this is exactly what is being represented by many of these politicians, but sending ordinary people into this froth. And mainly it is because they can't face the idea of who is really responsible, so they need scapegoats below them.
Yeah.
I mean, they couldn't begin to challenge those above them.
Yeah.
Because they are these incredible authoritarian personalities, and that's the stuff of fascism.
Yep.
So I'm not, I'm not just calling names. General Franco believed in the entirety of an imaginary Jewish Masonic Bolshevik plot against Spain.
Hmm.
So, what time is it?
Yeah,
oh, man, I'm two minutes late.
You were right on a roll. I didn't want to stop
you.
Yeah,
okay.
You
know,
we're
going to do this at 20 after.
Okay, you're such a tease.
There's two movies out. I'm not even going to give the name because I don't want to give them any publicity. One of them says that Barack Obama, so they must admit that in this movie that... that in fact Barack Obama, this is apparently very unusual for a right wing anything, that Barack Obama was in fact born in the United States, because they said that Obama's father, as listed normally, was not his father, but actually it was a black American communist.
Oh my God.
So these people are nuts. But what it is, really? Again, this is not a centrist politician who has policies you may disagree with, but rather it is this hysterical response to the sense that this world that people thought was whitopia is collapsing. Well, I mean, it's been collapsing for the last 50 or 60 years, folks. It's just been kind of a slow roll to the floor, and now it's beginning to speed up because we allowed this Reaganomics under Reagan and to some extent under Clinton, but then on steroids under Bush to crash the economy. So it's not a Muslim, America-hating,
socialist,
communist, socialist, pinko, whatever. It's
take away your guns.
Yeah, take away your guns. Yeah. And even and Romney, although he doesn't say the worst things, it turns out to be the most craven politician in decades, a man who will say anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He wants it bad.
He was in this a lot of you know this. He was at this campaign stop in Michigan, in Canton. And he says, I'm glad to be home. Anne, his wife, was born at Henry Ford Hospital. I was born at Harper Hospital. No one has ever asked to see my birth certificate. They know this is the place that we were born and raised. What a son of a bitch.
Yeah, just pompous ass. I know, really.
So, what? And I got more, but I will.
You have 30 seconds.
All of what? We got to, oh, I thought we were going to go to spot.
Yeah.
So here is my shocker to my radical comrades.
Okay. I'm ready.
My liberal friends will probably be happy. I never voted for a Democratic Party candidate until 2004, which I saw what was that guy's name? Gore.
Yeah.
In 2000. I always voted for small parties, for socialist parties, or green parties, or something like that. Because to me, the difference between the two parties wasn't great enough. Well, right. I mean, the gap and the gulf has widened significantly. So, the Republican Party really is the home of right-wing crazies. People that want to drive us back before the New Deal, back before even the progressive era with that, you know, had, standards for safety and meat and all that other stuff like that. So there really is a difference. But, you know, when radicals, people that are not only have extreme views like myself, I mean, extreme that we want things, big change that I think would help the country, would help the vast majority of people. It would hurt the 1%, help the 99%. It's the opposite with the extremists in the Republican Party. All they're about is helping the 1% to the detriment of the 99%, or really, probably the 80% or something like that.
Okay.
Of which I'm not in.
Right.
Okay.
Nor am I.
No, you're not. So one of the things that happens with Democrats have always been the subject of criticism from the left. I mean, from the left, or even from the left, saying that that Barack Obama or Bill Clinton, certainly Bill Clinton, was nowhere near even liberal enough
at all,
let alone radical enough or socialist enough or anything like that. So in that regard, I didn't support Barack Obama. I did vote for him because to me, again, it was a referendum on this president. The Republicans are tucking him out of sight, right? His name is George W. Bush. Yeah. He started two wars based on lies, were unfunded, destroyed the economy.
Illegally elected.
Yeah, allowed 9/11 to occur on his watch when he was fully warned and everything like that. One of the worst presidents in American history, which is why the Republicans want to keep him out of sight, even though is it his big brother or his little brother, Jeb?
I think he's little brother.
Isn't he? He said, Obama, stop blaming everything on George. Like that. So this is hard for me to say publicly. I'm going to get an Obama sign for my lawn.
What?
That does shock you?
Yes.
All right. Okay. Fellow radicals, leftists, socialists, stuff like that. All right. So why? Given that I have so many criticisms of Barack Obama. To my radical friends, they'll say this is this craven collapse.
You're a sellout.
Of a sellout of my radicalism of what have you. To the vast majority of people that pass by my house, my neighbors, and people that live in the general area that you and I live in separate houses.
Yes, as we always say.
As we always say.
There's been people who thought for the last 5 years that we're married.
Let's go on. the majority, 99% of everyone who sees this will think that I'm okay, that I'm a white person that's okay with having a black president. They'll think that I support.
Good.
Isn't this what they
this
will think?
Beautiful.
That they will think that I support. Some of them will think I support socialism. That's okay.
Yeah.
Some of them will think that I support the right of a woman to choose.
Yeah.
Availability of contraception. Yeah. That I'm opposed to these wars.
To the war on women.
The war on women, and you could go on and on and on like this, because really,
all good things.
What this election about, it's not even really about policy. I mean, ultimately it is. I mean, the Republicans want to have policies that will privilege the corporations and the financial sector.
And they'd love to get that in that Supreme Court.
But they, indeed. I mean, that's very important. But the people, for instance, the majority of whites that make under 50,000 that are still going to say they're going to vote for this, party that is committed to their destruction.
Yeah.
As a middle class.
It's that simple.
Yeah. It will have an absolutely different meaning. And so if there are my fellow red comrades out there that they want to say, come on, Pete, don't do it. But I think it is about what each candidate represents, because what Obama represents to a lot of these voters and the Democratic Party represents to a lot of white voters that make under 50,000 and will vote the Republican, it represents weakness, women, minorities, outsiders, touchy-feely, stuff
tree
like
huggers.
That. Yeah, people that care about other people when it should be just strong men running, men of steel.
Grab it and go.
Who said that? Oh, Hitler.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So, I'll join you in that.
Okay. I don't know.
I mean, currently, someone has a yard sign and someone doesn't. I feel like you don't even have a yard sign in your yard anymore.
Mine says slow 25.
I know. Mine says we are the 99%. Get with it, Peter.
Right. Hey, by the way, in many ways, if Romney gets in, it's not going to have a great effect on me. You can go to my website, and I figured it out. I always say, I didn't even know this. I said, what's happening is the new America. I mean, Romney talks about creating jobs and all. They're not going to create any jobs. They don't have any capacity to create jobs.
Exactly.
And I don't think Obama might not either. The economy there's a new economy. It's going to be a third of the people. I always say there's going to be well-waged. They're going to be at the center of well-paid wage work and commodity consumption, mess with the financial sector and all that. That'll be the top third. Well, I have this little thing on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, where you can figure out in what percentage you are in, among the wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
So I just squeaked in. I'm in the 66th percentile.
Ooh, Peter.
Yeah. So, nothing real bad's going to happen to me, but it's inexplicable to me.
But it's everyone around you.
Yeah, these people that are in the 50th percentile, the 40th percentile, that are going to be cut in the throats of their family's income, that women that are going to be jeopardizing their right to choose and to be what these fascists said in Spain, free women.
Yeah.
And what have you. And just one more thing. In fact, we're starting to get a lot of calls at 313-298-WRIF. This was in the New York Times today. Mitt Romney. Oh, here. This is what it said. Romney adopts harder message for last stretch nod to white voters. You know, that kind of wink and a nod.
Yeah.
And it says Mitt Romney is heading into his nominating convention with advisors convinced he needs a more combative footing against President Obama in order to appeal to white working class voters. I mean,
is sucking them in.
Does this mean, is this like South Africa? I mean, there is actually, somebody having a racial appeal based on, they want you to vote out of white solidarity. I mean, why don't they just run somebody from the Klan?
Yeah, no doubt. You know, what's scary is that person would probably win.
Well, he says he wants to persuade them that he is the best answer to their economic frustrations. Well, I don't blame people for being frustrated, but I would like someone to call us and tell us what they think the plan or the capacity of Romney to create jobs is.
No one can ever tell us.
No, they never have. Romney has added a harder edge to a message that for most of this year was focused on his business and job creation credentials.
What? From where what? And what huh? And when? And
what?
When?
What?
Yeah. Say what?
Hey, remember that guy that called in at the end was talking about he was going to vote for Romney because Obama was a gun grabber?
Yes, which is just the...
Yeah, because Obama's never done
ridiculous.
Anything like... Mitt Romney has, when he was governor of Massachusetts, he signed an assault rifle ban.
Well, there you go. Yeah. So be afraid of him there, fellow gun lovers.
You know, I'm going to stop and we're going to take a quick break and then get your calls.
Yes.
So I appreciate your patience. And I was going to, this is a 4-page article. I almost was going to read the entire thing. I know, bad radio. I know.
On the air?
Yeah, I know.
I would probably come over and shut your microphone off.
But it's talking about how all of these lobbyists are flooding into the Republican convention with millions and millions of dollars to give to the Republican campaign.
Oh, yeah.
Lobbyist trade groups, virtually all with business before Congress and federal agencies, are paying for a nonstop schedule of beach parties, concerts, and cocktail hours. And you say, well, they both do it. But no, In a bid to limit the convention's growing dependence on corporate financing, Democrats this year banned their host committee from accepting direct contributions from business and lobby. No wonder they have so much less money than Republicans. No self-imposed limits apply to the Republican host committee, which has a $55 million budget and is sponsored by corporations like Target, Chevron, and
who else?
Microsoft, yeah. Mm. Companies that one prominent Republican fundraiser, Brendan Winfrey, has reserved a private yacht for his clients, including Senators Thad Cochran of Mississippi and Jerry Moran of Kansas, according to invitations obtained. Companies that donate $10,000 to Romney's leadership PACs, political action committees, the maximum allowed, receive the honorary title of captain. So
it's a party time.
So if you are out there and you're making under, I don't know what, $80,000 a year, and you are thinking about voting for these. I'm not even telling you to vote for Romney. Yeah, I'm not even telling you to vote for Obama. I'm saying if you're thinking about Romney and you can't stomach Obama, stay home or vote for a Green candidate or vote
Jill Stein.
For them. Don't they have some right-wing party, constitutional party or something like that?
Oh, I'm sure there is.
Yeah, but don't cut your own throat.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The weekend is brought to you by Right Way. Guaranteed credit approval, $49 down and 2 full years of free oil changes. 888-RIGHTWAY or rightwaytogo.com. Get all of Drew and Mike's best moments delivered right to your computer or mobile device. The Drew and Mike Podcast, brought to you by Matt's Jewelry Brokers. For fast cash, call Matt's at 586-286-2866. Subscribe today at WRIF.com. This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
Keep them separated. separated. Hey, make a difference, make a ring. Keep them out. Gotta keep them separated.
Take a ride on the wild side with Motley Crue and The Riff. Listen to win a pair of tickets to see The Tour featuring Kiss and Motley Crue September 5th at DTE. One lucky Riff winner will take a ride on the wild side with drummer Tommy Lee, jumping on stage during the show and riding with T. Lee on his 360-degree roller coaster drum kit. Get another Riff exclusive from your concert station.
Hey, this is Tommy Lee, and you're listening to 101 WRIF.
The Riff. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. It's our second segment, and I just let loose with my shocker that I was going to put a Barack Obama for president sign on my lawn, and probably many of you thought, well, I would have thought you were. What's the big surprise? But Barack Obama has been, well, I wouldn't say a disappointment. I mean, he is a centrist politician. I support policies way to the left of him,
sure.
Very much like ones that make countries in Europe a much, much more pleasant place to live. Mm-hmm. You don't have mass murders. You don't have people without health care. Women have a right to choose.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have religious insanity. Like, this is like the Middle Ages. You know, we have the religious insanity here like the Europe had during the Middle Ages.
It's frightening.
Right. And I was also saying that I was driven by the remarks of both Hank Williams Jr., who said that Barack Obama is a Muslim president who hates the military and hates the U.S., by Ted Nugent, who said that it's a choice between good and evil, and that this was fascist hysteria.
He's hysterical.
Yeah, he definitely is hysterical. These movies that say that his father, that Barack Obama's real father, wasn't who he says it is, but a black American communist and all that. I mean, this is just absolute insanity.
Yeah, I never envisioned. I knew it was going to get crazy. I knew there was going to be a lot of racism coming out of the woodwork and showing its ugly head. But never, Peter, did I think it would be this ugly.
Yeah, it is pretty ugly. And someone called in and said they wanted me to explain fascism. Well, when we think of fascism, we usually think, I mean, it's a pretty good model of the fascism that took place in a lot of countries in Europe in beginning of the 1930s and Japan as well. And these are authoritarian governments, and they came into being almost exclusively as defense mechanisms against gains of the left and the trade union movement. And the countries that were run by conservatives, I mean, it's very complicated. You can't get it off in a few sentences on radio. But the conservatives, because they only represented this small little sector of society, and again, it was like it is now. They had these, you know, this greedy small 1% who were controlling everything, and the people said, hey, you know, we'd like to have some benefits for everybody and better wages and run things partly ourselves and have a democratic country.
Mm-hmm.
So the conservatives enlisted these mass-based fascist movements, and there was, I don't know, I'm trying to think of some shorthands for it, but it had a large element of psychopathology in it. I mean, it's they've been called the crazed hordes of the middle class, people that were just, were ruined during the Depression, for instance. And rather than revolting against their masters, they wanted a society that could provide them with the kind of stability that they had mythologized about the way things were. What's here, though, since there is no real left, and Obama's not a leftist, and he's not a socialist, and he's not a Marxist, is solely psychopathology. But in this case, the financial sector, particularly of this country, is trying to ride that psychopathology of American fascist hysteria into the White House so they can make more profits for the 1%, the people that are financing them, the Koch brothers and the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Best I can do. Where should we go? Well, let's do an order. How's that? That's fair enough. Here's Monster Mike in Birmingham. Hey, MM, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
We're good.
Yeah, I went and saw Joel Biafra of the Dead Kennedys over at Small's Pub in Hamtramck yesterday.
I didn't realize he was going to be there. Yeah,
he was in town. Jello Biafra,
Jello Biafra. Yeah, yeah. He was. He really knows his politics. He was.
Oh, he does. Yeah.
He was. You know, he was bashing the Republicans throughout the. He gives like political rails before each song. Like he kind of goes into detail. You know, in politics, he really knows his politics.
Well, wait a minute. I didn't even know I thought he almost did stand up. Not so much, you know, not like straight ahead comedy, but more sort of humor based on irony. But he was actually singing. He had a band.
Yeah, he did all this, all the Black Flag. I mean, he did all the Dead Kennedy stuff. He did all the stuff from the Dead Kennedys.
Yeah. I love it. I don't know. I think of all the songs he did. I remember one of them. And this was from like the late 70s, Dead Kennedys. And one of the lines was, "You're an adult. You're boring."
That's great.
Wow. That's absolutely incredible. And the fact that, I mean, the band was, maybe it wasn't that big. It wasn't exactly, you know,
band. They're known,
but
though,
he's at,
you know.
And Smalls is a nice room in Hamtramck.
Yeah,
but that's
a fun place to
see
a show.
Getting down there.
It's a fun place to see a show. You know, speaking of boring, I meant to tell you this.
Thanks.
I was broadcasting live last weekend, and the crazy preacher people were out with their big signs.
At the Dream Cruise.
Yeah. And, you know, usually I don't say anything. Yeah, I was just like, whatever. But I was just in a mood. And
yeah,
I said, I just walked by and I just casually said, "Proud atheist, have a good day." And he said, "You're boring." It's like, that's all he had for me.
Well, he really knows how to hurt a girl.
I laughed.
There's actually an atheist summer camp that's going on. It's got over 600 kids going to it. It's called Camp Quest Northwest. And
wow.
It's located just north of Seattle, and it's a summer camp for atheists or children of atheists, self-described free thinkers, or people not otherwise traditionally religious. And the amount of non-religious people, atheists and agnostics, is really climbing quickly. 34 million Americans consider themselves agnostic, atheist, or have no religion. And it's doubled since the last 20 years or so.
Amazing. Yeah.
So you got a camp for atheists. And they were at a Christian camp. They rented it from Christians.
No way.
And the Christians, they said, you're atheist? You want to rent? Sure, no problem.
Yeah, we need the money.
So they took so the atheists took masking tape, and everywhere it said God or Jesus, they put the...
Oh, God.
So what did they have? They just had signs up there that just said the Lord? Or no, you wouldn't put that. I'm thinking about Christ.
Know.
All right.
That's
Let's go on.
Funny.
313-298-WRIF. Here is Todd. Todd's in Madison Heights. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Peter, good.
Yes.
Love the show.
Thank you.
Every weekend. We had another Michigan artist sell himself to Romney.
Who's that?
Kid Rock.
Oh, yeah. Kid, I mean, I don't understand that guy. I mean, he is so down with Detroit. He moves into Detroit. He's given so much money, you know, for...
Perfect to be a lefty.
Yeah, he's perfect. He's a perfect lefty, except what could be wrong
with
him?
He's friends with Hank Williams Jr.
Is he?
So, yeah.
He really
is? Yes, he is.
Well, at least the kid has not come out with any insane statements the way like Nugent has or Hank Williams Jr.
True.
Yeah. No, I'm
somehow he balances things out a little bit.
Listen, you know, you don't want it 100%, I mean, the vast majority of musicians are left wing.
Entertainers in general.
Mm-hmm. In general, artists, creative people.
Right.
Yeah, that's one of the things fascist states do. They immediately start killing them off.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. You're right, Todd. Yeah. What I was saying was, even though I have lots of criticism of Obama, I was going to put an Obama sign on my lawn, and I wonder if I should call this one guy by name. He's always writing in on our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall, that I'm selling out or that I'm not radical enough. Call in. Why shouldn't I put that on my lawn? Because I say, this is not about policy. I mean, ultimately, the policy is going to happen when somebody like Romney gets in. Are you ready for some real bad news? University of Colorado, which has this polling system or something that has been predicting winners for the last 40 years.
Yeah.
They've never been wrong, and they picked Romney.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Say it isn't so.
Joe.
No.
All right. Here's Duck Lips. Hey, Duck Lips, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how's it going?
It's going good. What's up, man?
Hey, I did something today that will smack the Christians right in the face, which they need. I became an official atheist minister. I didn't know that was real till today.
Yeah.
$25. I'm now legal to actually marry atheists off.
Hey! I'm thinking about getting married. Maybe you can marry me. I mean, not marry me, but, you know.
I know what you mean, but I could do
it. You should see Peter's face.
There's a shocker. sign?
That's more of a shocker than your Obama sign, maybe.
It's called the Church of Dudism. It was founded by Dan, the guy that played Dan Conner on Roseanne.
Really? It's the Church
John
of...
John Goodman?
No.
Yeah, it's the Church of Dudism. It's all about
Dudism. Oh, all right.
It's a real church. I got the letter. I'm getting the letter of good standings in 3 weeks, signed by him.
Yeah, you can. You know, there's no way because of the laws that they can stop people. Like there's the Church of the Subgenius, and the famous one though. That's not the one I was thinking of. What is it that people, two friends of mine are ministers of this church. Universal Life Church, yeah. And they've married all sorts of people. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can do it. So you can marry anybody, you know, and that's what's important because, like, for instance, this whole thing about marriage equality and whether gays should be, married or not. You know, sometimes they say, oh, what's the diff? Are they going to have civil unions? I just heard this the other day. There are over 100 benefits that accrue to people that are legally married.
Oh, my gosh.
I think when this comes before the Supreme Court, even with these right-wingers on the court and, you know, majority Catholic, that they are going to hold that this is unconstitutional. Churches could say, you know, hey, we're only marrying men and women. I mean, they can do whatever the hell they want. Remember that one church recently refused to marry a black man and a white woman?
Yes.
Yeah, it's up to them. I mean, these are horrible people that ought to...
No, it was a black couple.
Was it?
Yes.
Oh, that's even worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
But, you know, I'm sure that they would refuse an interracial couple.
As a civic institution of a legal way of attaining status within society, that's certainly to be able to refuse whoever wants to get married on whatever basis or whatever their gender, that is clearly not equal protection under the law. Well, Gaia bless you, Duck Lips. And,
yes.
Yeah.
Reverend?
Yeah. There may come a time where I'm going to have to call upon you for your services. Hey, all of a sudden, open lines up. Nobody gives a crap whether I put an Obama sign on my lawn or what. All right. I thought it was a big deal. I mean, aren't there anybody who thinks I'm selling out, you know?
Do you want them to think you are?
No, I mean, I want to hear this. I mean, I could be talked out. I don't have it yet. Where was I? Oh, I think I got rid of it. Here. I mean, there's a couple of people. Well, wait a minute. Is that gone? Where did... Oh, I'm sorry. One of our emailers. Sorry, I'm trying to... You know, everybody else has 9 producers. So this is not quite as easy. Raskolnikov writes in and says, I, too, am voting for the lesser of the two evils. Well, Raskolnikov, are you putting a sign on your lawn? That's the thing. Simply stated, the choice between Obama and Romney is like choosing between gonorrhea and syphilis. Not a pleasant thought, but neither is the choice in November. Well, here's the deal. I mean, if it's equal bad choices, then, you know, what the hell? You might as well, stay at home or vote for the Greens or the Constitutionalists or whatever the hell they are on the right. But, you know, one of the things, I think I mentioned this a couple of times before, Noam Chomsky said, the farther you are away from the center of power, the more it is important which party is in office. Because, like I said, Bush was in office. In fact, I did pretty well during that period. We were doing that nationally syndicated show together.
We
paid off my house, you know, I mean.
Wow, you did?
Yeah,
nice.
You were at our mortgage burning party, weren't you?
I was? Oh, gosh. That was so long ago.
And you were so drunk.
I was not. You know, I do enjoy a cocktail now and then.
Yeah,
though.
Right. I'm her designated driver.
Yeah, I love it. It's perfect. We do, I don't know if you mentioned this, we have a couple of open lines. So if you'd like to call, 313-298-9743.
Okay, here is Kyle. Kyle's calling from Ohio. Go ahead. You're on the air, Kyle.
the heart of it all. What a massive place is. How are you guys doing?
We're good.
Good.
We're,
how are you?
Oh, I'm great. Shit. They brought me here from Texas, you know, and I'm going to watch my language, ma'am. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm not bad in front of women.
I mean, that's like, anyway, continue.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Are you with me?
I just want to hear you guys talk, honestly. Shoot, I listen to you every night because, heck, I'm up partying all night and all day. I'm dead, but I'm alive, so.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, it's just stressful.
So you like a few cocktails when you listen to Night Call?
Well, shit, I'm...
He's done.
Yeah, you're
Goodbye.
Out of here, man. You cannot control
Hang
your mouth.
Peter.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah, there we go. Michael in Rochester Hills. Go ahead, Michael. You're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're good.
Hey, I think, Peter, you need to come and sit on my couch and we need to talk for a little while.
Oh, God, okay.
Why, are you a psychiatrist?
Yeah. I think you're kind of losing it, Peter. You know, you should stick to what you know.
Where did I go wrong?
Well, you know, anybody with the name Barack Hussein Obama to begin with, you know, and then you got that other guy.
What?
I mean, this is like picking between, let me see, like probably the devil in the Antichrist.
That's now, wait a minute.
Yeah, what do you mean?
That was like kind of a blatantly somewhat
stupid racist
thing.
Hey, what's your ethnic background, Michael?
Ethnic? I don't do ethnic. But
well, no, wait a minute, man.
Are you white?
You're not Native American. Where the hell did your ancestors come from in Europe?
Well, I'm a human being. I don't believe in that.
Okay,
so
so
you're a human being.
And that guy's not.
You're getting on Barack Obama because his middle name's Hussein.
Yeah.
That is.
You know what my name is?
Bunch of crap I've heard.
My name is Peter Hussein Werby.
I'm Julian Hussein Jordan.
Yeah, but you know what? When whatever ethnic background you were at some point, unless you're just Anglo-Saxon from England or Scotland,
from racist,
yeah. But if you're German, if you're Irish, if you're Jewish, if you're something like that, there was somebody that didn't want to hear that Kraut name or that Frog name or that Jew name or that stuff like that. So just watch your mouth. You're injecting poison into our society. I mean, you're the kind of person that throughout the society has made it difficult for people to live, because rather than trying to find what unites us as a common humanity, rather using I don't have an ethnic background. I mean, you're full of it, man, or you wouldn't have said anything that stupid. And how you can say that publicly and not expect to be called out
and be okay with yourself?
I don't know. Come on, shake.
You're the one who needs a psychiatrist.
Shake yourself, right? I shouldn't say who said it, but someone typed it. It says, laughing out loud, Michael in Rochester, what an idiot.
Well, yeah.
But you know what?
He or she said it.
Yeah. But it is really harmful. And sometimes, you know, it's hard to get over prejudices, and it's a lot easier to find somebody that is exactly like you, the same color, the same name, the same food, the same religion, and all of that. But that's not the modern world. We live in a global world, and we always have
diversity.
But it's even more so now. And, I mean, you really come off like a stupid person. And I'll tell you, Michael, if you go out in the world of work and utter stuff like that, you're really going to limit everything, including, and I don't even know why this isn't the first thing, but like job possibilities. You know, like if you worked here, I heard that from you, you'd be
out of here.
Ass.
Goodbye.
All right. We'll be back. Hey, we got open lines.
Lots of open lines. Call around.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com. Rock in Detroit at 101.1 FM and the rest of the planet online at WRIF.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Keep listening to 101 The Riff for your chance to take a ride on the wild side with Motley Crue's Tommy Lee, September 5th. Get all the details online at WRIF.com.
Get ready. We're ready.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
Welcome back. This is our second hour at 1 a.m. I'm going to have some interviews I did previously. One is called Sex and Punishment.
Is it about whips and chains?
No, well, it's about this 4,000-year battle to repress people's expression of sexuality. Yeah.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
Yeah. And then the other one, another good one, which I know what it is, but I'll think of it in a while.
It's about the
Oh, it's about Detroit the newspaper, news. Detroit newspaper strike from 1995 to 2000. Yeah. Oh, we've been, a couple of things. One, I'm saying I'm going to put a Barack Obama sign on my lawn, even though I have lots of criticisms of Barack Obama from the left. He's not left enough. He's not socialist enough. He's not. He's not socialist at all. He's not left
he's
at
not
all.
Muslim enough.
He's not Muslim. No. He's. But we just had an awful call from a guy named Michael who said started talking about
Barack Hussein Obama.
And Jolene and I said, as we've said before, our names are Peter Hussein Werby and
Jolene Hussein Elaine Jordan.
Okay. Never knew your middle name.
You didn't?
Yeah, we. Been married all these years.
I feel like I don't know you anymore.
We're not married. Also, we're talking about the Tampa Convention. The Republicans must have incurred God's wrath because, that's what they feel happens. But one of the things, they're always talking about small government.
Absolutely.
They're in this convention center.
Oh, this is good.
Which has been, like, completely publicly financed, publicly owned. The local government is giving the Republicans $2.7 million. Oh no, I'm sorry. Well, much more than that. Where is the for security? Oh yeah, the host sites have received $50 million in federal grants for convention security.
Small government,
$18 million from the federal election campaign fund for the 2012 conventions. And the city of Tampa is spending $2.7 million in beautification projects. So the Republicans are meeting in a socialist convention center.
How about that?
And what does that mean? You go, well, is they're coming? No. The individuals, although in some cases they can, individuals could not afford to put up the stadium, this convention center, so the cost was socialized, right? To create that.
You know, I'm supposed to be there right now.
I know.
Protesting.
I know.
And a little glitch in the plan, but we have a lot of people that we know that are down there.
So there's a lot of people. So I said I want to hear all of this. First off, I got
to
make sure.
Yeah, get to the phones.
I got to do this one. But I want every one of you to stay on the line. Lunchbox and Chum Jeff, who says he's in Tokyo, could be doing Skype. Buford, Tom, somebody who on line 5, whose name I can't read, and Stu in California. Well, let me get to the people that are.
Let's go to Japan.
I want to make sure that people aren't
Tokyo, Michigan.
No, I want to make sure people aren't in St. Clair Shores and they're going to say they're in Mexico City just to get on fast. All right, here is Jeff. Jeff, you're in Tokyo?
Oh yeah. Hi, Peter. Hi, Julian.
Hi.
You're on Skype, aren't you?
I am on Skype.
I could tell by the
call. I love when we get calls from Tokyo.
Do you speak Japanese at all?
A little bit.
Yeah. Give me a couple so just we know we're.
I can say "skoshi dake desu," which means a little bit.
Okay.
Okay, perfect. That's
I can say "ichiban dashi."
I can say nothing.
Ichiban.
Dashi? You don't know what ichiban dashi means?
Ichiban is number one.
Yeah, and a dashi is a soup stock.
Yes.
So it's ichiban dashi. Yeah, there's a Japanese Japanese beer called ichiban too.
Oh,
all right. Yeah. So
it's good.
Okay.
That's my favorite.
Okay. So Jeff, you listen all the way. Are you from Detroit?
Windsor.
Windsor. Okay.
Oh, wow.
Well, this is really thanks for making our show international for sure. What are you doing over there?
I've been here for like 20 years, so.
Oh, great.
Did you
go there for work or?
Yeah, I'm working here. Yeah. Working, living.
Okay. So did you have, from Tokyo, did you have a comment?
Yes. I just want to talk about a couple things that you guys were talking about a few shows back because I listen to the podcast all the time.
He still has the Canadian accent, too.
You do.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So the first thing was about a caller, maybe this is a few weeks ago, was talking about buying a gun in Canada.
Right.
And we were talking about, he said it's fairly easy to buy a handgun or whatever in Canada. And that's semi-true. You can buy a handgun in Canada. You can get a permit to buy a handgun. But what he didn't say was it's very, very difficult to get a permit for that gun to ever leave your house.
Oh.
Oh.
And unless you belong to a gun club, which is quite expensive, you'll probably never get the permit to carry that weapon out of your house.
Yeah. Well.
So it's not like people are carrying them around.
Right.
In fact, they're trying to make, Harper's trying to bring in a law where if you're caught with a handgun outside, without a permit, it's an automatic 3-year jail sentence.
What?
Now, this is Stephen Harper, the very conservative prime minister of Canada, because you gotta know, Jeff.
Yeah, he's probably a bit less than Obama, but.
Yeah, 90% of Americans, maybe more, do not know who the prime minister of Canada is. They have no idea.
Yeah.
They have no idea.
Yeah, and like I said, he's a bit left of Obama, probably.
You think so?
I don't think so.
Yeah, he's still very much for the health care.
Oh, of course.
Well, yeah, I can't change that.
Well, that's the same thing in Britain. I mean, the conservative prime minister there would no more try to repeal the national health program than I don't even know what. So, yeah, and in that regard, he is. Well, listen, I got a ton of calls. This is great hearing from you from so far away. I appreciate you listening, and I thank you for your opinion.
Okay, well, one quick thing.
Sure.
Take a look, if you have a chance, take a look on the Internet about an off-duty Michigan police officer in Calgary. He became the laughingstock of Western Canada recently.
Okay.
What did he do?
He was in a park. The big park in Calgary, and some people came up to him and were saying, "Hey, have you been to the Stampede yet?"
You know what, Jeff? This is way too long a story. I know the story.
He just said, "I thank the Lord Jesus Christ. He did not pull a weapon on me," and he complained that he couldn't carry his gun in Canada.
Yeah, no, he was from Kalamazoo, actually.
Yeah,
Kalamazoo, that's right.
Yeah, right. It is an incredible story. Thank you, Jeff.
But now you better look it up because now you've all left me hanging.
No, all you got to do is just put in Kalamazoo Cop Calgary.
Okay.
You got it. Yeah. All right, some more from here's Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota. He says, Peter, don't put that Obama sign on your lawn. Why not? Why not, Tom?
Well, you mentioned that you could vote for the Greens, but... Just that phrase that you're voting for the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
I don't think you're voting for anybody. I think you're voting against the most evil.
Right.
And so
absolutely.
You're making your vote a negative. And so it's like negative campaigning, negative voting. I think that you can get something out of voting. The person that you vote for could win. Or you could say, oh, good, I've done my civic duty. I've tried to be a good citizen,
and I carefully
voted for the person who I thought was best for the job.
But if Mitt Romney got in, that would be completely disastrous.
I know, but that would be voting against the worst evil. But you can vote for Jill Stein, and as long as you don't vote for Romney.
Green Party, yeah.
Yeah, and Jill Stein,
we wish Jill Stein had a chance. We wish Jill Stein.
No, for sure she does.
There was a level playing field in this country where everyone could all the candidates could equally give their opinions without needing hundreds of millions of dollars from, the 1%. But Jill Stein, who, she has a platform that I would, get on in a second, but
get other buddy.
Well, wait a minute now. I said 90% of Americans don't know who Stephen Harper is. Probably 99% don't know who Jill Stein is. And that's an indictment of our political system. I mean, to me, to defeat the forces of the far right wing that have coalesced around Romney and Ryan is just a matter of getting breather space, because this is all eventually going to have to be settled by a mass movement, a democratic and small d democratic mass movement of people that are going to say, hey, listen, you know, we're all citizens here and we're not being shuffled off into peasantry by the Koch brothers and, you know, their stooges, Romney and Ryan. You hesitated, Tom, a disaster on talk radio, so thank you very much.
You're harsh.
Cruel but fair.
He was listening. Sometimes I think they're just actually listening, and they don't know that you're going to pause, but you just go, bam.
All right. Let's see. Let me get this one quickly. Here's Stu from California. Stu wants that we were, let me just set this up for a second, Stu, that I was saying that much of Romney and Ryan's support comes out of this fascist hysteria that sees Barack Obama as this, like Ted Nugent said, of this contest between good and evil, this Muslim president who hates the country.
That was Hank Williams.
This secret agenda to do, to, you know, to drive us into socialism, all of which is absolutely nutty. And somebody called to Sarah, our phone screener, and said, tell Peter to define what fascism is. And Stu's in California, wants to elaborate a little more. Go ahead, Stu. You're on the air. Where are you calling from? What city?
Yeah, I'm calling from Hayward, California, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, I was watching the Ron Paul We Are the Future rally earlier today, and his speech there. One of the reasons I listen to Ron Paul is because he railed against fascism and the evils of fascism, just warning his audience to look out for fascism. But you won't hear that from any other candidate. You know, they'll talk about socialism, but that's fascism, one word that is rarely ever used.
Right. Well, but, you know, he would not, and he would not, you may know this, but he was asked to speak at the Republican convention, but he had to submit his speech to the Romney advisors, who would say what he could say and couldn't say, and he had to fully endorse Mitt Romney, and he refused, unlike his dumbass son.
Well, on the subject, if I was listening correctly, if I heard it correctly earlier when I was listening on, you know, somebody had asked, what is fascism?
Yeah.
The word fascism itself derives from the word fasces. Fasces were the reeds that were tied around the handle of a battle axe at Roman times. And this was carried in the Roman Senate as a symbol of the power of the magistrate in the opening ceremonies of the Roman Senate.
Right, and there's one on the dollar bill.
Right, if you watch on C-SPAN, they do it today in the United States Senate. There's a big object that's carried. It's a wooden carving that's carved in this, you know, the fashion of one of these battle axes that has the fascist lashed around the handle.
Right.
And Mussolini is the one that coined that term. And if you think about why he would have selected that term, what do these fascists do? They reinforce the handle, and they give you a better grip. And fascism in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, it developed basically as a response to socialism. When you think about it, the difference between fascism and socialism on the one hand, or the difference between monarchy and democracy on the other hand. Monarchy is about the concentration of power, and democracy is about the diffusion of power.
Yeah.
Socialism is about the diffusion of power, and fascism is about the concentration of power. And as a mechanism of fascism, they had to figure out how to get a handle on society so that the wealthy class could maintain control. And fascism is one of the mechanisms for that.
Well, yeah. And that's what I said. There was a challenge from the left. I mean, the left said that capitalist society was so unfair and it treated the vast majority of people. There wasn't a middle class, essentially. I mean, a teeny one of administrators and small businessmen.
TikTok happening here.
Yeah, and so there was this insurgent left going on, and the conservatives, who always supported fascism in every country in Europe, and Germany, and Italy, and Spain, and Poland, and Romania, and all Japan, all the places that fascism came to power, Fascism is actually conservatives' evil twin. All right, I got to move on. Thank you for that, Stu. Appreciate it. Yes,
got an email. Peter was talking about how he's putting an Obama. You are putting an Obama sign in your yard, and someone wrote in. I don't know the name. Peter, you didn't sell out. You smartened up.
Yeah, I don't know. No, that, see, you say that, it makes me.
I know.
I'm not
I know. And it's not helping.
Yeah, right. That doesn't help. I'll still do it. Here is Buford. Buford's in Garden City. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
If you'll indulge me for a short statement on Nugent.
Yeah.
I have been very disappointed with him, and I understand that he never did drugs. He should have.
Wait. Let me just say that. You actually kind of phrased that badly, Buford. You should say Ted Nugent said he's never done drugs.
Okay. I'll buy that.
Yeah.
Okay.
As far as Obama, you know, when you say that, and, you know, you're just passing this on, I understand. When you say that he leads the party of the weak, because it's a party of women and gays and et cetera.
Yeah.
I think it's really sad that we don't teach people what strength is. I wanted to say that a strong man is one who's strong enough to be gentle, strong enough to care. A weak man is the scared, ignorant man who operates with anger, hate, and force to enact draconian measures necessary to keep their lives simple, plain, and vanilla.
They don't have inner strength.
Or resources, so they have to force their outer world to conform to their sad little ideals.
Yeah.
Very good.
And
that's my comment. That's all I had to say.
Well, I think that
excellent.
You said a lot.
You said a lot in there. You
Thank
did.
You, Buford.
Dave from Livonia wrote to us, Peter, said that he loves the show, but, and I don't remember us doing this, but please don't blanket all Catholics as right-wing conservatives. I'm a proud Catholic and a proud voter. I enjoy your show and listen every week, but he gets angry when we paint all Catholics under the same brushstroke. We don't do that, do we?
No, I don't. I mean, almost
all. Maybe it seems like it. The
only
Catholic.
The only Catholics I know are left-wingers.
Peace and social justice activists.
Peace and social justice. I mean, I don't know any other Catholics.
Yeah.
I mean, do I? I don't know. No, I don't think the most. Pax, P-A-X, Pax Christi, you know, Peace Group. I'm trying to think of all the others, you know, there are. So, no. For a while, I mean, until this very conservative pope took charge, there was a huge, in fact, that's one of the things that Pope Benedict is trying to weed out the liberal elements.
Yeah.
We're not supposed to mention that he was in the... What? The Hitler youth.
He was a little Nazi.
So Catholics, I don't know how they range, whether they, I mean, one of the reasons, there's a number of reasons they put Paul Ryan in. One is they hope to get the Catholic vote because they think, well, gee, you know, that we in the Republican Party are against contraception and abortion, and that'll get all the Catholics in, except the majority, what is something like 90% of Catholics practice
birth control. Yeah.
And great numbers of them have abortion.
We've talked to many of them
sure.
on this show.
So, no.
Tom wrote in and said he put his old Obama sign out the other day, if anything, to just irk the haters like your previous caller.
Yeah.
He mentioned the Harrison's Island Ferry, the bridge, and a whole other subject.
Well, and if you're just joining us, I was saying that it wasn't even so much what concretely Barack Obama has done or not done, but that to have an Obama sign on my lawn, where I live, says a number of things. That it doesn't matter to me the racial, ethnic background of a person. That I support a woman's right to choose. That contraception should be a right for everyone to have.
You are concerned about Mother Earth?
Yeah, oh yeah. The environment, peace. I mean, I'm not even saying that...
You're anti-war.
I'm not even saying that Obama... embodies all this in his policies, but that's what he represents to people. I mean, the Democratic Party, I think, the Democratic Party politicians fool a lot of people because it represents that to them a party of peace and social justice and harm reduction to everyone.
Fairness.
And fairness, all that. Peace, love, and understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just no drugs.
Yeah, I almost said dope, didn't I? Peace, love, and dope. Peace, love, and understanding. Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
But, the Republicans are not fooled at all. Well, I mean, I mean, what they represent is what they're actually getting, you know. I mean, the Democrats.
What do you mean?
I mean, I'm getting too confused, but,
okay.
Too confusing, I should say.
Yeah.
That all the people in my family that are all these liberals,
yeah.
I mean, they just vote for Democrats and then they get disappointed that they're not as liberal as they thought they were going to be. Whereas I wasn't disappointed in Barack Obama. I didn't think he was a big left winger or even a liberal.
Well, not a very liberal person.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk to Fred. Fred's in Detroit. Go ahead, Fred. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Jillian, Peter.
Hi.
Hi, Fred.
Well, first I want to hit you with a quick factoid.
Okay.
And that's that on the CBS Evening News tonight, they announced that Tampa, where the Republican conventions are being held, they have the highest homeless rate in the nation.
Oh, wow.
And of course, the Republicans are going to conveniently overlook that.
Oh, yeah, they'll probably find a place to, you know, hide that whole fact, right?
Right. And then later, CBS 60 Minutes reran that Grover Norquist deal. And I have to say, and excuse my language, but he is one smug bastard.
That's okay.
It's okay.
And as far
mouth?
You know, Catholics go, I heard the leader of the nuns on the bus.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, it's good to hear that these women are out here, even though they represent the Catholic Church, but they're out here trying to do good for the society. And it's sad to hear some of these guys come along, you know, these good, hardcore Catholic white and Hispanic males who want to defend the upper class. You know, for instance, they think a minimum wage is a bad thing.
Well, yeah, the other thing is, too, is that the Vatican is trying to squash, I can't remember the name of the group, but it's something like Religious Women in America or something like that. It's this unified group of nuns that take part in all of this good work in the community and are very, very liberal. And, the idea, they're trying to, you know, muzzle them big time. All right, Fred, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Here from Jerry writes, remember that, Michael from Rochester was calling,
saying Barack Hussein Obama.
Yeah,
which name like that.
Yeah, you know, which, by the way, this is what all these far right wing talk show hosts, that's where he gets it from.
Yeah, yeah.
But, Jerry talks about, Willard Mitt Romney. Got to use three names to make him sound like a mass murderer. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, they do that. That when people are arrested.
Like Hillary Rodham Clinton? Or whatever they
well, you know, like for instance, the guy who didn't kill Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah.
I mean, no one called him Lee. Hi, Lee Harvey. This is Lee Harvey. I mean, his name was Lee Oswald.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But they put that in there, I think,
for effect.
I think, too, is they want to make sure kind of to identify somebody fully, you know, that...
Because there's other Lee Oswalds.
There could be other Lee Oswalds, yeah.
I would change my name.
All right. I am not seeing information about the people up on the screen now. Okay, let's see. Wait a minute, but let me get this.
That's strange.
Lisa just called in to say she's Catholic, Christian, and gay. She's voting for Obama, as is her sister, who's Catholic and gay as well.
You go, girl!
That doesn't go down. I mean, you know, religions change, but it is. Listen, one of the things is that Paul Ryan, the vice presidential Republican nominee, and this piece of work, Aiken, this representative about legitimate rape, they want.
Wasn't his name Todd?
Todd Aiken, yeah, right. They said they want no exception in these anti-abortion laws. They want to abolish Roe v. Wade and let the state decide who can terminate pregnancy and all that. But this is the third time I've done it tonight. I forgot, where was I going? You don't know.
I don't know. Just take a phone call. And we have some open lines.
Okay, yeah.
313-298-9743.
I'll get it back in a minute.
Okay.
Oh, I see.
I couldn't save you this time, Peter.
I see. Line five is Tim in Belleville. Yeah, there you go. It's Tim in Belleville. Go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to mention that I don't think Mitt Romney understands America. If I have a pile of money and it keeps growing for not creating jobs, why on earth would I risk doing it to start with?
Yeah.
And if you go back and look at when Clinton raised taxes, they created jobs. When Reagan raised taxes, they created jobs. They're not going to do it as long as their pile keeps growing. It's when it starts not growing that they're going to create jobs.
Well, Tim, don't you think it's strange that these vastly wealthy people want more money? I don't know who you are, but I'll bet you you don't make $400,000 a year. Is that a good guess?
No.
Is that a good
no.
guess? Me neither. But could you imagine having $400 million and then backing a candidate that's going to reduce your taxes so you get another $2 million a year? I mean,
well,
that's insane.
Like Adelson, he threw away $20 million with Gingrich fighting against Romney, and now he's throwing millions to Romney.
Yeah, this is this crazy. Yeah, people don't
and
know.
And it's like chump change to him.
It is. It is.
You know? It's like, well, let's go to the casino and blow a couple hundred. Oh, no, let's blow 30 or 40 million.
It is indeed.
And it's a shame because they don't see that a strong middle class is what's going to, their money's not going to be worth, well, I won't say anything
bad.
Yeah, good. Where the sun don't shine. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Some open lines again.
The sun don't shine.
313-298-WRIF. Here is Chunky and Lunchbox in Port Huron. Go ahead, you're on the air.
I'm scared.
Yeah. Hey, are you there?
Yeah, we're here. Are you there?
We're there. Here.
All right, first of all, I just want to say I'm a huge fan of the Riff.
Good. We're rocking.
We both are, you know, Autorama every year.
Love Autorama.
Good.
Yeah, you and me both, man.
That's my favorite car event.
What's that?
That's my favorite car event.
Oh, you and me both. I've been going every year for probably 7 or 8 years now.
Sweet.
Anyway, this whole Obama ordeal,
yeah,
I think it's preposterous.
What's that?
Which part?
Okay, well, first of all, did you hear about the Russian submarine that was armed with nuclear-tip ballistic missiles in the Gulf of Mexico?
No.
Google it. You'll find it. It happened within, I'm not joking, it happened within the last 3 or 4 weeks.
How come nobody else heard this? Because one of the things, you know, we have battle groups all around the world, and I always say we're the only country that does it. I mean, you know, it's not like China has, you know, battle groups off our shore or Russia does. Now, you're contradicting that. I mean, this...
No, dude.
Yeah, go ahead, dude.
Google it. You'll find it. I swear to God, you'll find it. But yeah. Our U.S. Navy was too busy to send out a patrol because we were fitting our submarines with torpedo tubes so women of the U.S. Navy could launch them. That's why they were too busy to go out on patrol.
This is insanity.
Where you're reading like some...
Like The Onion.
Yeah, this sounds like The Onion.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was only the USA Today, but I guess, you know, they're mistaken.
Okay. Listen,
USA Today?
I
still have a newspaper?
Yeah, they do. All right. I don't know whether you're Chunky or Lunchbox, but I will go look that up during our break. So that's good. All right. Thank you very much.
We have open lines, and should we break and then come
We're going to break, yeah.
Okay.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Detroit's Rock Station. On the web, thanks for listening to WRIF.com. Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com.
you were to everything I've been through, you wouldn't know.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to our final segment. Hey, we're not going to be here next week. It's Labor Day. We're going to be at Arts, Beats, and Eats.
Oh, yeah.
The Detroit Jazz Festival, or just kicking back.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, well, time to get a call in.
We're working all weekend.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to be doing nothing. All right, we just had a caller, Chubby and Chunky,
and
Lunchbox, yeah, said that there was a report of a Russian nuclear sub patrolling the Gulf of Mexico. It went undetected. It went undetected. How did they know? But guess who, you know, who was really all over it? Sarah Palin!
Oh,
remember her, that loser?
Yeah, she pops her loser head
out
every once in a while.
So, an official with the U.S. Department of Defense on Wednesday denied media reports that a Russian nuclear-powered submarine recently operated in restricted U.S. waters for up to a month without being detected. I mean, read this sentence. It went without being detected. Wayne Snyder, a spokeswoman with a spokeswoman with the Pentagon, said, "I don't know what the information was based on, but it was not correct." And I don't even want to give the name of this far right wing paper. So this again, this is more fascist hysteria. You know, our enemies. I mean, so
and you believed it.
Yeah. So you could say, well, why do you believe them? Well, I thought all the righties were really down with the Pentagon to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But let's look at this. Let's figure, one of the ways you figure out what's true and not true is figure out what makes sense. Although the United States has always had this strategy of surrounding the Soviet Union and then Russia with its our military, it's never done that for it's never done that to us. And there's no way in the world that President Putin would send this would be an act of war, because see, we can do that to everybody. We can have an Africa command and a South American command, a European command, all of this, and none of these other countries have anything like that. They don't have troops stationed anywhere, and they don't send battle groups into, like, the Panama Canal or something. And we have something called the Monroe Doctrine that says, this is our territory, you stay away.
Yeah.
And it's almost like an act of war. So it is absolutely illogical that Russia would send that. In fact, I think they said something else.
It's really amazing what people will believe.
Yeah. It said a Russian attack submarine also sailed close to the shores in 2009. Whoa, I'm trying to look for where all this. Oh, they said that U.S. bombers had entered United States airspace. Well, I don't know if they're still doing this, but for years and years, the United States had constantly had B-50 nuclear bomb-equipped B-52s in the air at all times, and they would go up to a certain perimeter of the Soviet Union and then turn back. This is what I said. This is fascist hysteria. I mean, the first thing that I would do, as you said, dude, would be to, Google this and then see the sources. And you know that it's being put out by the most unreliable people on the planet. Just because it's printed here doesn't mean it's true.
Right.
So if you say, well, I don't believe the Pentagon, then you have no respect for our armed forces.
Ooh.
Ooh.
There's that.
All right. So, forget about that. Well, let's see. Tim in Belleville mentioned, he said, Adelson giving money to, what was it? What's that guy? I'm forgetting all these people. So there were, this is the fourth time I've done this?
No, I'm trying to think of it now. We need a vacation.
He had a name too. He had a weird, they all have weird names, you know? I mean, people think Obama's weird. What about Mitt?
Ron Paul.
No, Ron's okay.
No,
the guy from Georgia. Yeah, with the many wives, the guy that he's always cheating on his wives. Now he's like a very deeply religious.
I have no idea.
Says he's an historian. He got hundreds of thousands of dollars from the federal government.
I have no idea who you're talking about.
Come on, I don't know why I can't think of, I can see him. He was a Speaker of the House.
Boner?
Not Boner. That's who is the Speaker now. During the Clinton administration.
I don't know.
God.
I got nothing. But did you hear about that one, the senator that, you remember he had the Latin lover?
Oh, yeah.
The woman in Argentina?
Yeah.
And he said he was walking the, what's the trail? We're losing it.
the Appalachian Trail.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And but
this is former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford.
Yeah. And so he was actually in Argentina, right? Or Venezuela?
Banging his babe.
And so it was a big marriage scandal and all of this.
He had to resign, and he was another one of these religious conservatives who was actually involved in this long-distance adultery.
But now they're getting married.
Yeah, but so, it turns out it's kind of cool. Yeah, the guy blew off his straight-ass Republican wife and got him a
Latin lover.
Hot Latin lover. Yeah, Newt Gingrich.
Newt Gingrich. Oh, gosh.
Peter. All right. So he gave Newt Gingrich $20 million because he wanted Newt to be president and not George Romney. And, of course, you know, the Democrats have not started.
Newt Romney.
What did I say, George?
Just carry on.
What time is it?
Show's almost over.
It's okay, but I got more coming. Anyway, Sheldon Adelson is this casino tycoon who is totally nuts as well. And he said he's willing to spend $100 million to defeat Barack Obama. And that, that shows just the thorough corruption of the whole electoral system, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. But here, this is what the New York Times said a few days ago. It's called Enthrall to Sheldon Adelson. This is amazing. 3 days after Paul Ryan became the Republican vice presidential candidate, he made a pilgrimage to the Las Vegas gambling palace of Sheldon Adelson, the casino tycoon who is spending more than any other donor to try to send Mr. Ryan and Mitt Romney to the White House. No reporters were allowed into the meeting, perhaps because the campaign didn't want them asking uncomfortable questions about the multiple federal investigations into the company behind Mr. Adelson's wealth.
Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, this guy is a piece of work.
Corrupt. Huh?
Those questions, and one of Adelson's complaints about Barack Obama is that, that Adelson doesn't feel Obama is strong enough on Israel.
Oh, you're kidding me. He hasn't done anything to prove otherwise.
No.
He's still giving him millions and millions and millions and millions.
Of our tax dollars,
yes.
Yeah. Those questions aren't going to go away, and neither are the ones about the judgment of Mr. Romney and Mr. Ryan in drawing ever closer to a man whose business background should lead them to back away fast. By not repudiating Mr. Adelson's vow to spend as much as $100 million on their behalf, the two candidates seem more than eager to keep the super PAC dollars flowing than to preserve the integrity of their campaign. And then it just goes into this whole thing about the Adelson Las Vegas Sands Corporation. It's under investigation by the Justice Department, the Securities and Exchange Commission for possible violations of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and on and on and on and on and on and on like this. But I'm trying to think if this one is in here when... In 2001, when China was making a pitch to hold the Olympics, it was worried about a resolution pending in the House that would oppose the bid because of the abominable human rights record of China. To curry favor with China, Mr. Adelson called Tom DeLay, then the House majority whip.
God, remember him?
Didn't he go to jail?
I think he did.
Yeah. And some corruption scandal. And another recipient of Mr. Adelson's campaign generosity urged him to block the resolution, according to this court deposition by William Wagner, then president of the Sands. Mr. DeLay quickly promised the bill would never see the light of day, and he was true to his word. The next day, a Chinese vice premier promised Mr. Adelson an endless line of the gamblers to the Macau casino. A careful presidential campaign would put distance between itself and a businessman like Mr. Adelson. Instead, this one is cultivating him. Mr. Romney recently met with him in Israel, and Mr. Ryan this week paid homage to him and other big donors in a private casino for high rollers on the 36th floor of Mr. Adelson's Venetian Hotel. By allowing Mr. Adelson to have such an outsized role in their race, the candidates themselves are placing a very risky bet. I would say that. I mean, it just shows utter corruption on that. All right, let's go to Lynn. Lynn's in Wolverine Lake. Go ahead. I think that's a town. You're not in the lake, right?
No.
Are you there? Hey, Lynn. Oh.
Okay.
No, she's there. I think.
Elaine, well, it's a bad connection. Call
I'm
back.
I'm going to put you on hold. See what's up.
Can you see if she's there? Please. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know what happened. Maybe I scared her with that. So, I don't know. You know, I'm going to be so glad when this election is over.
I know. Well, and the nastiness really hasn't even begun. I mean, it has. But, you know, I was just thinking, gosh, it's almost September.
Yeah.
It's about to get real ugly.
Well, we've said any number of times, wouldn't it be nice if the campaign was like 3 weeks, you had a couple of
debates,
maybe say two or three debates. And what are they going to have? How many? Three debates, I think.
I don't know.
And then, you know, it's going to be a trip is Biden and Paul Ryan, Vice President Biden.
Yeah, I would actually tune in just for that little freak show.
Yeah. Well, you know,
I like how Biden just smiles and laughs the whole time when he does these debates. Like, he's really like, dude, are you kidding me?
Well, remember one of the things they got up on Biden for, he said to this audience.
He always says kind of dumb things here.
Well, he said he told these people that the Republicans want to put him back in chains.
Yes, yes, yes.
And then the Republicans went crazy and all that. Well, it turns out that Sarah Palin said the same thing.
I know.
Yeah.
I saw that.
Yeah. But, I mean, and one of the things, by the way, everything about it, the extent of it, the corruption of it, the charges and countercharges, it really drives a lot of good people away. I mean, for one thing, I don't know.
Well, people just get tired of the negativity.
Yeah, where was I that I was catching out of the side of my eye, I don't know if it was a bar or something like that, that I was seeing nonstop anti-Obama ads. Right?
Oh, really?
Yeah. And after a while, so then you see all the pro-Obama ads and the anti-Romney ads. And after a while, you think to yourself, if you don't really do a lot of stuff, I wonder which is true. Or maybe you think, you know, that each of what they say about the other is true.
Right, yeah.
And that would lead...
Yeah, very confusing.
And that would lead an honest, decent person that's kind of low information...
Yes.
...to say, I'm just going to stay away from this.
Right. It's a total turnoff.
Because one of the letters that we said, was someone said it was a choice between syphilis and gonorrhea.
Yeah.
Is one worse than the other?
Oh...
Syphilis kills
syphilis,
you.
I would think. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I think Lynn is back. Let's try Lynn again. Lynn, hi, are you with us? Sorry, I didn't mean to scare you.
That's okay.
So you're in a city called Wolverine Lake?
Yeah, Wolverine Lake. It's just off between Wald Lake and Commerce Park.
Really?
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just a little itty-bitty place.
So what's up?
Okay, the first time that I ever saw a Ron Paul sign, I think it said RuPaul.
Okay,
that's funny.
Yeah.
I'd vote for RuPaul. Just for the fashion.
Yep. That was it.
Okay.
Okay, well, okay, thank you.
We need a little humor.
We do. I wonder what's happening. There was a big Ron Paul rally, and as I said, yeah. Ron Paul has refused to completely endorse
Romney.
So it's going to be interesting. I wonder if there are any Ron Paul voters out there that and supporters
that
considered yourselves really radical, where you're going to vote for this arch right winger that supports, by the way, everything that Ron Paul is against.
Yeah.
Maybe say, well, these are small government, but for all the wars that Ron Paul opposed, Romney and Ryan are for and they're not going to do an audit of the Fed. Forget that.
Yeah.
You know. In fact, Rand Paul has called for an audit of the Pentagon. I'll go for that.
Wow. Hey.
I mean, I don't think do an audit of the Fed as well. But Ron Paul opposed the Patriot Act. It's a serious invasion of civil liberties.
Remember that? It was just such a huge document. You know, a very large stack. And they gave the Senate, Congress, like 2 days to read the whole thing. No one read it.
Yeah. All right, here, a little earlier, a guy called in, what was his name? Oh, yeah, Chunky and Lunchbox, and they said that there was a Russian sub, according to a report. He kept saying, Google it, dude.
Yeah.
So this dude Googled it, and it was pretty clear it was BS. But let's see what Dominic has to say. Dominic's in Ludington. Go ahead, Dominic, you're on the air.
Peter, you suck big donkey balls, you douchebag.
Right.
Hit it.
Yeah. Well, it was just some jerk off. Yeah. Here's Shane and Warren. Shane, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing today?
We're good. What's up?
I just wanted to throw out a few comments, if you would listen, about, there was a gentleman a little while ago talking about the lesser of two evils and talking about third party options. If I'd like to comment on that.
Go for it.
Please.
I have more left-leaning views, but as I, you know, I've been following politics as long as I can remember, it seems like, or at least history and government. And what I've seen is I really looked at these two parties, or at least these two views of liberal and conservative, and really understood the, propaganda between the both of them. And it's really turned me off and really shifted me in the more anarchist or third party realm, because I feel like I've been let down by both, you know, Dems and Republicans.
Well, Shane, we're there with you. I mean, that's not the option. I mean, the option is, so what does that lead us to do? What should we do?
I was having this discussion with my friend recently. I told him I am not voting. I do not care. I am a cynic. That's what the message I was ultimately trying to convey. And he convinced me that, you know, all this talking you do about politics and social views, you have to vote and make some sort of statement. And he's a big Ron Paul guy, which, I mean, I'm not saying that I disagree with that, but I believe that I'm probably going to vote third party now just to make that statement saying, I'm here, I'm listening, but I'm not agreeing. And if an abundance of people do this, it'll be noticed that people are starting to vote third party. I mean, Libertarian Party, Green Party, Freedom and the Liberation Party, I believe, is another one. These parties need more attention. But, again, the 1% is not going to lobby the candidates from these large parties because it's not within their, you know, business interest.
Well, also, as what I said earlier, somebody like Jill Stein at the Green Party has a wonderful political platform as opposed to the Republican Party. If you read that through, it's absolutely frightening. I mean, the Democrats' platform is filled with a lot of good platitudes. But you know what? I'll tell you, Shane, it's what I said earlier, and you are a good representative of it in a very positive sense, and that is that people like yourself that have a high sense of personal and political integrity get turned off by both the parties.
Exactly.
And don't vote. And the Republicans are literally saying good, because they, one of their main ways that they're able to win, like they did in 2010, for instance, is when people don't vote, or voter suppression. And I don't think we've gained a tremendous amount by getting the Democrats in, but at least keeping the Republicans out would be, I think, is an important thing. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. By the way, one of the things that the Republicans are doing, they have passed laws in about 30 states that are about voter suppression, about, for instance, demanding voter ID. In Pennsylvania, they estimate that there are 750,000 people that don't have full ID and that will not be able to validate that they are a registered voter. And so the Republicans say, well, isn't that proof that they blah, 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 you know, like that. But in order to be registered on the rolls, and I don't know how they did it, they had to have some form of identification. And, there, you know, in Pennsylvania, you know how many in-person voter fraud cases there were? Like zero.
Right.
You know where the fraud is? Like Thaddeus McCotter, the Republican representative from around here, who were, you know, circulating false petitions or turned
trouble,
in.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of indictments and what have you. In fact, here, this says, even as Pennsylvania became the latest state to uphold a restrictive voter ID law, of 2,068 alleged election fraud cases since 2000 shows that while fraud has occurred, the rate is infinitesimal, and in-person voter impersonation on election day is virtually non-existent. Like, how could they do it? Like, someone would say, I got an idea. I'm going to go into, let me see, I can find out where Peter Werby lives, and I'm going to go in and vote for Romney. So they go in there and they say, hi, who are you? And they say, well, I'm Peter Werby. Where's my ballot? And they go,
you've already been here.
Hey, dude, Peter Werby just voted an hour ago. Or wait a minute, I know Peter Werby, and it's not you. So there, the voter in-person fraud is ridiculous. What the voter fraud that goes on is a kind of mass voter fraud and suppression, the kind of that stole the election for George Bush in 2000 and in 2004.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. Let's see if there's in an exhaustive public record search, reporters for News 21 in Philadelphia sent thousands of requests to election officers in all 50 states asking for every case of fraudulent activity, including registration fraud, absentee ballot fraud, vote buying, false election counts, campaign fraud, casting an ineligible vote, voting twice, voter impersonation fraud, and intimidation. The database turned up 10 cases of voter impersonation. With 146 million registered voters in the U.S. during that time, those 10 cases represent about one out of every 15 million prospective voters. In Pennsylvania, when this law was passed that demanded voter ID, the head of the Republicans in the Senate says this will carry Pennsylvania for Romney.
Ooh.
So, I mean... All right.
Bad.
One final note, and we got to go. Tom Hayden, one of the founders of Students for Democratic Society, SDS, from the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be at the St. Clair County Community College, and he was a principal author of what is the Port Huron Statement. If you don't know what that is, that's worth a... it's worth a Google.
When's he going to be there?
Thank you. Tuesday, August 28th at, 8th at the Fine Arts Theater on the college's Port Huron campus.
That's Tuesday.
Free event. Hayden is marking the 50th anniversary of the Port Huron Statement that launched, really, the 1960s opposition to the Vietnam War and also to racial segregation. Tom Hayden. Incredible guy. And also, there is going to be at the University of Michigan in October a 50th anniversary celebration of the Port Huron Statement.
You're going to have to look that up, yeah.
Okay, hey, thank you. We're going to be gone for a couple of weeks because of Labor Day. Sarah, thank you so much for doing it all. Thanks for listening.
And we have there's a bunch of emails that we didn't get to, so just we'll read them.
By January, we'll get back to
them. No, we won't.
We'll get to them soon. Stay tuned.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com. Everything that rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
RIF HD1 Detroit.
What's the matter with you guys?
It's like a regular freak factor.
Everything that rocks.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I don't think I'd be telling you anything you don't know if I said we live in a society that's steeped in sex, sexuality, lust, desire, all of that. I mean, it's everywhere we look. I was just listening the other day, and a father is saying he didn't even want his daughter to watch football games because there was so much sex in the advertising and what have you. And so it's everywhere. It's not true in every society, not true in Iran, for instance, but everywhere here and Iran, there's also forces of repression trying to tamp down on one of our most basic drives. Incredible books come my way. It's called Sex and Punishment, 4,000 Years of Judging Desire. So we're talking about when the first city-states arose, right? They're already saying, no, no, don't touch, don't do that. The author is Eric Berkowitz. He's a writer, lawyer, and journalist. He has a degree in print journalism from the University of Southern California. He's been published in the Los Angeles Times, the Los Angeles Weekly. He was the editor of the West Coast premier daily legal publication, the Los Angeles Daily Journal. We're reaching him at his home in San Francisco. Eric Berkowitz, welcome to the Peter Werby Show, and in a sense, welcome home, huh? You're a Detroiter.
Thank you so much. Yes, I was born in Detroit many decades ago, but I still have family there, and I think of Verner's and Saunders Fudge with affection.
I think for people under 30, they're going, what? Well, that was ginger ale, folks, and, well, the fudge is self-explanatory. But anyway, let's get to your book, Sex and Punishment, 4,000 Years of Judging Desire. So we get this kind of bizarre social institution after a million years of small band association and tribes, and all of a sudden you've got, sky gods and patriarchy and all that. And the first thing they do, pardon me, is to start clamping down on sex. What's up with that?
Yeah, when I first began to research this book, a friend of mine asked me, Eric, what are the first laws? And I really had no idea. And I went back to the first written laws that we could find, which are from Mesopotamia, from maybe 2500 BC, maybe a little further back. And easily a third of them had to do with sexual activity, sex, adultery, which, by the way, was the first death penalty crime I could find, adultery, sex with animals, etc. And it seemed to me that the restriction and channeling of the sexual urge has been, from the beginning, associated by mankind with society itself. That is, we can't have a civil society unless people's rather unruly sexual urges are channeled into directions that don't cause chaos.
Well, there are, what's unruly in one society is not unruly in another, as you lay out in Sex and Punishment.
That's absolutely true. That's a very important point. What I found as I plowed through a lot of material was that what is harmless fun in one society could be, as I said, an abomination or a death penalty crime in another. For example, homosexuality was pretty much ignored by ancient law. Not that it was legal or illegal, it just was ignored by the law until really the Hebrews came around, which was actually fairly late in the game, and homosexuality went from a non-event to a crime on par with murder. And I think we're really only recently coming out of that. In fact, it's still, as we know, a rather radioactive subject. There's one story or another that pops up on the subject virtually every day.
Well, one of the things that my guest Eric Berkowitz does in his book, Sex and Punishment, 4,000 Years of Judging Desire, is he looks at certain cases, certain historical situations. And I was taken by the one in Rome with the charioteer. Maybe you could relate that, because here comes, in what was it, 370 or 90 or something like that, here comes a Christian senator. So this has some big antecedents for what we're going through now, huh?
It was an amazing case. Yeah. Yeah. Let's go back to Greece around the 4th century A.D. We've got Rome, which has just become Christian, and only very slowly. And their emperor, Theodosius, has accepted Christ into his life wholeheartedly. Unfortunately for everybody, the people of Thessalonica didn't. And they had a chariot racer who was the equivalent of, you know, the ultimate sports hero, beloved by everybody, who was arrested by the local soldiers for essentially being a homosexual. That didn't make the crowd very happy. There were about 60,000 people waiting for a pretty good race. They didn't care about his sexuality at all. So they rioted, killed most of the soldiers in town, and caused a lot of trouble. Theodosius orders a retaliation. The soldiers come in and kill about 7,000 citizens of Thessalonica.
Wow.
Absolute chaos. The way it all resolved is Theodosius felt fairly bad about unleashing a police riot and ended up having to seek forgiveness from the local bishop. The result? From that point on, the church controlled Rome, not the emperor. The whole thing started with a popular outcry against the arrest of a gay charioteer.
So this was like a watershed event. I mean, here,
watershed.
Yeah, I mean the goes from secular authority to church authority. But I mentioned that there was a Christian senator that played a role in this. This is not one. He didn't get caught like in the baths doing anything that some of these right-wing senators do. But he I read this a couple of weeks ago. I can't remember exactly, but he there was a figure in there in the Roman Senate, right?
Well, there were Roman senators who were converting to Christianity and pushing this very, very hard. So Theodosius was had the ear of everybody, and he was, as the time passed through the 4th and 5th century, Christianity began to become more and more accepted. This was a watershed event. And people who were practicing pagan religions, which were not considered there was anything wrong with it, in the early part of their lives, were getting hung up on meat hooks in the later part of their lives, all for doing things that were accepted until they're not.
Right, and the pagans, of course, were much more Randy Bunch than the kind of straight-laced Christians that were beginning to have the dominant religion.
Yeah, yeah. They weren't as randy as you would think from the movies, but they all had their own rules. But Christianity really adopted the view that the body and the soul are the same thing, and if one conducts sex in a way that they believe that God didn't approve, then everybody is exposed to danger. I'll give you one more example.
Sure.
Justinian, who was a Roman senator, a Roman emperor, truly believed, based on the Bible, that earthquakes were caused by people having homosexual sex. And when he looked around and he saw pestilence or earthquakes or famine, he linked it directly to sexual misconduct, and that's how people paid. And so, you know, I come from the Judeo-Christian tradition, but I at this point we have some power of reflection, and of course we know that one person's sexual conduct doesn't affect another person's fate, but that's a hard belief to shake.
Well, you would think, I mean, probably when listeners heard that an emperor thought that homosexuality created made a society incur God's wrath, it sounds pretty nutty. Yet we had, and I can't remember which of whether it was Jerry Falwell or one of those guys after 9/11 said that it was caused by lesbians and the ACLU and what have you. So in a couple thousand years, we haven't traveled with some of those folks much of a distance.
Peter, you just hit it right on the head. To people like us from Detroit, from the large cities, we hear these comments by these rural religious authorities, and we think that they just sound like crackpots. But actually, what they're doing is they're tapping into a very, very long-standing mental and spiritual and social tradition that really is best left behind. And, I mean, we can see it in some of the news today. I'll shift gears just a little bit. On rape cases, there's a lot of people who talk about how a woman doesn't get pregnant when she's actually been raped. They actually believe that for a woman to get pregnant, the only way for religious traditions, which in for centuries, women who were pregnant, the courthouse doors were slammed in their faces because the conclusion from judges is, hey, you're pregnant. You must have enjoyed it.
Hmm.
Well, anyone that reads up to page 10 of a decent medical text knows that to be false, but it's the tradition that stays. And I think we've come a long way since the, let's say, the Middle Ages, but we still need to look into ourselves and realize that that freedom is a very hard-won thing and it's very easily lost.
Well, I would. Well, let me just take this opportunity to reintroduce you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Berkowitz, and he's written the book Sex and Punishment, 4,000 Years of Judging Desire. And you can go to the website, sexandpunishmentthebook.com, sexandpunishmentthebook.com. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, .com. Now, you have an added two words there, probably more than you would have liked. It would have been great just to have sexandpunishment.com. Do you remember what happened when you went to the Internet and wanted to have sex and punishment? Because I should have Googled it ahead of time because I can just imagine what's there.
Yeah, we had a marketing company set up the Facebook and the website, and we had to put in Sex and Punishment, the book, because merely the word sex and punishment take you to other places, of which your listeners can very easily imagine. The idea of having sexual material so available on the web is itself a subject which the book covers, which is profanity and obscenity and when and how that first came to be controlled. And the truth is now anybody could get anything of a sexual nature on the web if they want. Profanity laws and obscenity laws really only came into being when sexual material became available to everybody, that is, with the printing press. Before then, there was no less pornography, but it was just held by those who were able to buy it and keep it. As soon as the printing press made pornography available to, let's call them, the masses, that's when the Vatican and governments began to throw people in jail for producing it.
Well, something is dreadfully wrong when if I would like to see if I could, like I'm doing now, covering the word punishment, you could have sex and love, sex and fun, sex and joy, sex and I don't know what, sex and child.
Sex and happiness.
Yeah, sex and happiness, all of that. And linking that up, this basic drive, this desire to repress human emotions connected with the desire to, you know, to have sex is pretty I don't know what. I mean, I should have a more intellectual word than creepy, but that's what comes to my mind. But it's pretty predominant in state society. I mean, there's a real connection between sexual repression and the role of government throughout the last 4,000 years. That is repressive.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a question we could use the word channeling. Because it's a very rare government that will try and bar sex entirely. Generally, what they're trying to do is channel a very, very powerful urge, an urge that Plato said was stronger than hunger and stronger than the need for warmth, in a way that either makes the right people money or keeps order. For example, there were a lot of church-owned and state-owned brothels throughout the Middle Ages. This is at the height of Christian-influenced society. Why is that? Well, there was money to be made. Clearly, prostitution itself violates every possible Christian and Jewish ordinance on sex. You know, it's fornication, it's lust, it's everything else in the world. It's generally adultery. But the church for centuries had its own chain of brothels, and the brothels made a lot of money and built a lot of churches. In fact, the
wait. Let me. I rarely interrupt authors, but I could imagine Eric Berkowitz, someone saying, "Wait a minute, this sounds like a Catholic smear, an anti-Catholic smear. Give me a little. I'd never heard this one before. Give me a little, verification of that."
Peter, all I can tell you is that this is hardly a smear, and it's the last thing I feel like doing is smearing anybody, especially religious authorities.
I know
but
that.
The record is absolutely clear that both cities and the church from about 900 AD to about 1600 AD until the Reformation, what they did was there was the Saint Ignatius said that brothels were like sewers in a castle. If you don't have a sewer, the filth is going to back up. They saw them as essentially cleansing mechanisms for Christian society. Men were able to go and do things with prostitutes that their wives may not want to do. It prevented more egregious forms of adultery. It also provided revenue. There were many, many records of church-owned brothels supplying the coffers of churches. In fact, I was about to say that in Florence, the city of Florence opened up a brothel, which they called the Office of Honesty, because their justification was that it got men, young men, interested in women early enough, and it prevented homosexuality. Men weren't getting married till they were in their late 20s back then. That was how society was set up. And it provided sexual opportunities for young men of the right sort. you can make your own conclusions. But it was really only until the Reformation, Martin Luther, the rise of Protestantism, that official brothels began to be shut down.
Yes, I did not. I wanted to just let you explain that more. And if you go to Eric Berkowitz's Sex and Punishment Index, under brothels, there's about 20 entries there for more information on that. We live in a society now. Well, actually, let me. I want to bring up one other point. You mentioned sexual rules so that there wouldn't be chaos. I mean, in countries like say Iran and Saudi Arabia are wonderful ally. They don't even want any hint of a skin other than like a nose or sometimes not even that and fingertips to show of a woman because men might be overcome by lust. But every society. I think you were indicating, has its rules about sexuality. And I said that the first million years or so of human existence on the planet was marked by small band association. And not, folks, we're not talking about rock bands here. bands of people banding together and tribal units. And they, too, had their rules. I mean, who was eligible as a sexual mate and when one had sex and who instructed young men and young women in sexuality. So it's not like they're before these strict state and church rules, there weren't any. I mean, because a number of feminist anthropologists say that before all this, like cats and dogs, men would have sex with anyone. They would with their daughters or with whoever. I mean, that mating was non-discriminate. So there had to be, in order to expand the nature of the human association, they had to start putting these rules on there, and they had to It hurt the gene pool and all that. So I don't know. I'm here. I'm going off of my own thing. Let me get. So every society has rules about sexuality. Some just seem worse than others, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I think the Iranians would, the Iranian government, and I make a big distinction between Iranians and their government.
Sure.
I think the Iranian government would probably be a little embarrassed to know that incest itself was very much a part of ancient Persian society and, in fact, was considered holy. Incest, to me, and I'm sure everyone listening to this program, has a very big ew factor. It's, you know, it's horrifying and wrong, but it's crazy to think that in many societies, many advanced societies, such as ancient Persia, it was also venerated. The truth is, Peter, that you know, for much of early societies, I mean, what you're talking about, you know, when people lived in very, very small groups, people didn't even make the real association between sexual activity and reproduction as much. There was a lot of sexual activity going on. Women were lactating much of the time. They didn't make the association. But the truth is that when people began to form more complex societies, they began to acquire property and wanted to leave property to their children. And when really male control was firmly established, you know, one of the sexual rules began to be written and enforced. One thing that we haven't talked about is adultery. Adultery, I don't think, happens any less now than it ever has. And it might be against the law in some states, but no one ever enforces it. It's a moral wrong. It's very problematic for a lasting marriage, but it's not really a crime anymore. It really was the first and most savagely enforced crime. Why? Male ego, primarily also, men wanted to be assured that their children were in fact theirs.
Mm-hmm. And
their property would go to their actual children. And I think it's when we began to be less concerned with that and we could develop more complex contracts, that sort of fell by the wayside.
I was going to say, yeah, the patriarchy enforced by the political state, but with a lot of emotional content to it.
Absolutely.
As well. We're almost at the end of our conversation with Eric Berkowitz, the editor of Sex and Punishment. And we didn't even get to, and I think stayed away from some of the examples. I mean, because the punishment inflicted on people that broke sexual rules in everywhere between Mesopotamia and Kansas are pretty horrific and pretty frightening.
Yeah.
But I wonder, you have a little statement that came with your book. It says, you would be glad if, after reading my book, people paused before they condemned others for their sexual behavior. Meaning what? Flesh that out a little, if you will.
Thanks for asking that, Peter. I mean, yes, there are some very, very colorful and gruesome examples of the lengths people will go to control others and their sexuality. Much of it we almost can't even accept emotionally. And I think when we hear the news throughout the campaign and onward, we're constantly hearing people calling. It's almost like the Queen of Hearts from Alice in Wonderland. Off with their heads, off with their heads. We have to stop, and we have to reflect that what is morally and sexually proper for ourselves is defined by ourselves, and acceptance of another person who does it in a different way or in a way that we wouldn't consider, that might be a trigger for a conversation, some counseling, if there's no force involved, some you know, some good, healthy interaction. But unless a person is exerting power over another through violence or through intimidation, we have to wait and think, is it right to rob someone of their freedom for this? Is it right to humiliate them in public for this? Is it right to disqualify them for public office for this? We need to stop, look at history, and learn from it. Because the urge seems to be that if someone is conducting themselves sexually in a way that we don't know or accept in ourselves, we have not only the urge to speak ill of them, but to actually hurt them. And I think that's wrong.
Indeed. In fact, there's a song from the 1920s called Ain't Nobody's Business If I Do. Eric Berkowitz, it's been wonderful talking to you. Your book is incredible. I would highly recommend it to people. It's called Sex and Punishment, 4,000 Years of Judging Desire. It's published by Counterpoint Press. The website for the book itself is sexandpunishmentthebook.com. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Eric Berkowitz, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
Hey, it's Drew here from Drew and Mike, and we all have our reasons for why we need cash right away. Reason number 27. The bills are all caught up. You're ready to go on vacation in a week, and suddenly your car's battery is dead. Then after you replace the battery, you find out, oops, maybe it's the starter or the alternator or both. Hey, no reason to panic. Just stop in at any neighborhood check and gold location with your unwanted gold, silver, or nearly any precious metal and coins. And check and gold will give you cash on the spot. I mean, what other options do you have? Borrow from mom and dad? Borrow from friends? Get a loan from the bank? No, I don't think you need that grief. Check and Gold gives you cash, not questions. They know there's a lot that can turn your budget upside down, so what have you got lying around? Gold, silver, diamonds, coins? Cash them in at any of Check and Gold's 11 suburban locations. There's one close to you right now. Call 800-574-GOLD. That's 800-574-GOLD. Or online at checkandgold.com. That's check, the letter N, gold.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. If you would have gone by my house between 1995 and 2000, you would have seen a sign on the lawn that said, "No Detroit News or Detroit Free Press wanted here." Both of our cars had bumper stickers supporting the great Detroit newspaper strike that occurred in that period. This was when the workers went out on strike, and we're going to get a little precision in terms of that definition, in protest of what was happening to the two daily newspapers in Detroit. An incredible book has just been published about it. It's called The Broken Table, the Detroit Newspaper Strike and the State of American Labor. It's written by Chris Romberg, and Chris Romberg is an associate professor of sociology in Fordham University. We're reaching him in his office in New York City. Chris Romberg, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Well, this was an incredible strike like most modern memory. It's probably gone from all of those except those who participated in it. And I should say, well, I guess I did, full disclosure, both being a union member and also just my sense of social justice, I was involved as a supporter quite consistently in those 5 years. But I wonder if you could just give us a summary so those that either, pardon me, don't remember it or don't know about it will know what we're talking about in your book, The Broken Table.
Okay, sure. Well, the Detroit newspaper strike was actually one of the largest and longest strikes over the last several decades. It was larger and longer than more than 95% of other strikes during that period. And it involved both newspapers, the Detroit News and the Free Press, and their corporate parents. And just briefly, on July 13, 1995, the unions representing some 2,500 workers went on strike against the papers and their joint operating agency, the Detroit Newspaper Agency. So that involved members of six local unions, including journalists, printers, press operators, circulation workers, janitors, truck drivers, all walked off to their jobs after contract negotiations broke down, centered around union charges of bad faith bargaining by the employers. The newspapers took a hard line and hired permanent replacements for the strikers and effectively militarized their operations. Altogether, the company spent an estimated $40 million on private security forces and paid out more than $1 million to suburban municipalities to cover police overtime at their production and distribution sites.
Do you think it was fair to say, Chris Romberg, that the newspapers realized that a new day was dawning and the unions, Gaia bless them, but didn't?
Well, the way I portray it in the book, in The Broken Table, was that it's really a clash of institutional logics. That is, the newspapers were pursuing a corporate anti-union agenda that really became prominent in the 1980s. And the unions were trying to defend the principles of New Deal-style collective bargaining. So the two sides were really playing by different rules.
Well, and what I meant by that, and maybe you could expand on it, the unions had a model, and you talk about it in your book, The Broken Table, had a model, as you say, from the New Deal, where there was negotiations and compromise, and each side realized they had to give a little. But ultimately, at the end of a labor dispute, the unions would be intact. The corporations would, have to maybe give a little more each time. But that, as you say, that's not the playbook that the newspapers were going by. They saw a new era.
It's true. I mean, in the current system, you could say that one side comes to the table looking to make a deal. That's the unions. Well, the other side comes looking to get rid of the table. It illustrates the impact of the rise of this corporate and legal anti-union regime. And workers have effectively lost the right to strike in the United States. For the sake of the country, I argue, I think we need to get it back.
Well, you mentioned, I believe, how few strikes there are any longer. We always think about, all during my youth and growing up and all of that, and being part of, a union, a broadcasters union, even to the point where there was a strike here one time years ago. We kind of took those for granted, but as I said, that increasingly that's part of an era gone by. There's just not strikes like there used to be, and not really any mass strikes of the nature of the Detroit newspaper strike that went on from 1995 to 2000.
Well, that's true. During the 1970s, there were an average of 289 major work stoppages involving 1,000 or more workers that occurred annually in the U.S. By the 1990s, that number had fallen to about 35 a year, and in 2009, there were no more than 5. And I think this is important because the right to strike was a crucial part of the system of democratic workplace government under the National Labor Relations Act, which was affirmed by the right to strike was affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1960 that said what you were explaining, that the right to strike is the last resort, but it was essential to maintaining the integrity of the bargaining process.
The decline
of unionization over the past couple of decades has been a major factor in the rise of American economic inequality, the distance between rich and poor now. But more than that, I think the political consequences are just as important. The loss of workers' right to bargain collectively in strike represents a significant de-democratization, as I call it, of American society in the workplace and in the community.
Well, besides employers, probably there's even some people that are in the middle class or the working class that would say, well, you know what? I mean, strikes create inconvenience for everyone. Just look at what happens like in England and France. You got general strikes and you can't get a bus or the food service is out and, or the garbage isn't being picked up. Maybe this is good. Maybe this works a little better. So we have less commotion in our society.
Well, sure, and that's the way it's often presented in the news media. I mean, what you hear about when you hear about reports about strikes are, how hard it is to get a flight or something like that, just the inconvenience to the consumer. But I think it has a greater underlying importance in terms of both the economic and political consequences. Like I said, the decline of unionization has been shown to be a significant factor in the rise of income inequality in this country, which has increased over the last couple of decades. But even more than that, it's a problem of there are fewer and fewer ways to hold companies accountable. That's why I call the book The Broken Table. That is, the ways in which workers and even members of the community could bring companies, large corporations, to the table and negotiate the conditions and terms of their employment and the consequences of companies' actions, those things have been eroded.
Chris Romberg is my guest. He's an associate professor of sociology at Fordham University. His book is The Broken Table, The Detroit Newspaper Strike and the State of American Labor. It's published by the Russell Sage Foundation. You can go to Russell Sage, that's SAGE.org. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Chris Romberg, how do you, what made you want to study this? And I mean, do you have a Detroit connection, or what signaled this might be a book worth writing and an issue worth pursuing?
Well, I actually lived in Michigan at the time for a brief period. I taught at Michigan State University from 1996 to 1997. So I was aware of the events as they were happening. And I do my research on urban social movements. My first book was called No, They're There, and it was a book about a social and political history of Oakland, California. So this is the kind of stuff that I do, and I was interested in had a few connections to the case. I actually attended the large demonstration there in 1997. So it seemed to me the kind of dramatic, really epic urban struggle that really shows the kind of conflicting forces that exist in our society. And I'm actually a union member myself. I'm a member of the National Writers Union, and when I was in graduate school, I was part of my teaching assistants union, which was affiliated with the United Auto Workers.
So we're union brothers. I'm a member of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, and that's full disclosure.
Sure.
And as I said at the beginning of the program, I was a supporter of all of the newspaper strikers and took part in many of the actions that Chris Romberg relates in The Broken Table, including the mass demonstration in 1997. But let's do this. Usually, and if people, you know, again, if their memory is not quite like mine since I was involved in it or don't even know about the newspaper strike from 1995 to 2000, this wasn't just, 30 guys, picketing out in front of one little place. This took on mass proportions and incredible community support. And Chris Romberg, I wonder if you could lay a little of that out of how that how that worked to the benefit of the strikers and actually, I guess, in a way, prolong the strike because the workers were not willing to give up given the support that they had.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that makes the case very interesting and unusual is, first of all, you had six local unions involved, and they all struck together. That doesn't happen all the time. And also that it was such a public strike because it was the newspapers, and it was spread over all the entire Detroit metropolitan area. It's not like you just had one plant going on strike. It was, every single distribution point, every warehouse, the two newsrooms downtown. So it was really very much a public event in Detroit history. And you're right about the community campaign. The unions organized a circulation and advertising boycott. They did civil disobedience and protest actions, and they even published their own alternative weekly strike paper called the Detroit Sunday Journal. Many people in the community rallied to their support. Prominent area civic, political, and religious figures stepped forward and urged a settlement, and circulation of the papers dropped by as much as a third. By their own estimate, the two papers lost a combined $92 million in the first 6 months.
That didn't stop them, though, did it? It was sort of an investment in the future, I think they saw it as.
Yeah, well, I don't think the companies expected to drop $92 million in
first.
I think they were very surprised by the amount of resistance that came up. But you have to bear in mind these were owned by the two largest newspaper chains at the time, which were Gannett, which owns USA Today, for example, and Knight Ritter. And so these were companies that had extremely deep pockets. And once they got into it, they just decided to bull their way through, I think.
Well, tell us some about the transformation, because that's what really struck me of the strikers themselves. I mean, these were, sort of real average in the best sense, and maybe model. Maybe that's what average always sounds a little pejorative. Model American citizens who worked hard, except for the journalists, were working class jobs, but with pay that allowed them to live a middle class life. And when I spoke to them, most of them said, "I'd never done anything like this in my life before."
Oh, sure. I mean, in many ways, well, one thing that was really interesting to me was the diversity of the employees who were involved and the solidarity they showed. That is, everyone, from janitors to truck drivers to skilled craftspersons, the press operators, to the white-collar professionals in the newsroom. The people who were on the picket line together really bonded in a way that was really extraordinary. And although the newspapers made a real effort to try to divide people and to make the journalists especially cross the picket line, for those who stayed out, many of them saw this as really a defense of their professional status, that it wasn't really about the wages. It was really about the control of the workplace and the nature of the collective bargaining relationship. that's probably a point I should make, too, and that is that the strike was not really about wages at all. It was really about the future of the bargaining relationship between the papers and the unions. That is, the newspapers, the unions formally struck over three principal unfair labor practice charges related to bad faith bargaining that were issued by the National Labor Relations Board. Now, you could ask, why would there be such a big strike over such apparently procedural issues, right? But they were crucially important. Some of management's contract proposals would have effectively bypassed the unions or undermined their capacity for collective bargaining. Others were going to cut union jobs and replace them with lower-paid non-union labor. So the unions saw these proposals as an effort to radically reduce their presence in the workplace, and to agree to them would have been an invitation to slow suicide. So I think the companies were trying to fundamentally change the relationship between themselves and their workers. And the unions felt that this was really a do-or-die struggle, and the employees, the strikers, went out for that reason, not really for the dollars and cents on the table, but to protect their rights.
And though the newspaper strike began in 1995, in many ways it presaged what we're facing today with the right for collective bargaining. I mean, that's they anticipated what we're going to be facing. My guest is Chris Romberg. He's written The Broken Table, The Detroit Newspaper Strike and the State of American Labor. And this is about the great, we always call it here in Detroit, the great newspaper strike from 1995 to 2000. And Chris, in your book, The Broken Table, you take us back to this very dramatic night of Labor Day, 1995, and I wonder if you could recount that. I just said that, and a chill just went down my back, because I was there.
Sure. Well, Labor Day 1995 was really just a couple of months into the strike. The strike started in July. But it became really the first major mass confrontation between the unions, the strikers, and the companies, who were allied with the Sterling Heights police. The major printing plant, I should say, for the newspapers was in Sterling Heights, Michigan, and that became the site of many of the most dramatic confrontations. So you were there, and you probably could say as much about it as I could. Over the course of the weekend, then, there were several dramatic incidents of clashes between police and strikers. But what I should mention is that the companies had basically enlisted the Sterling Heights Police Department early on. As early as January 1995, the company had started reaching out to the police departments, and that was 6 months before the strike even began, and well before negotiations even began. So that the companies then...
well, there was virtually pitched battles, wasn't there?
There were.
Yeah.
The police were arresting people for unlawful assembly. But it basically became just a way to disperse the picket line. And so the county prosecutor at the time, in effect the district attorney, Carl Marlinga, then had to issue a letter telling the Sterling Heights Police Department that, you know, you can't arrest someone for just standing there, right? You know, this is a violation of First Amendment rights and the National Labor Relations Act. It really became an incident in which the police department, as I argue in the book, was acting as an arm of the company.
And they called, it was on Mound Road, and there was this big island. Or what do we call it? I don't know, a boulevard. And the police, I don't know, might have missed this in your book. The police referred to the island as Treasure Island,
right?
Because they were making over $100,000 a year with all this overtime. So they were kind of delighted.
Yeah, that's another point to mention, too, actually, is that once the strike got started, then the police were spending an awful lot of time there, and the city was spending a lot of money to pay for the police and the overtime. And so they went to the companies, and the companies agreed to pay all of those expenses so that the city would send memos to the newspaper agency documenting, you know, or itemizing the exact amount that they had spent. And the companies would send a check to the city
to cover
for the exact amount right down to the penny. And this went on for over a year.
Well, just so we don't let our time get too far away from us, Labor Day 1995, there's hundreds and hundreds of union workers and their supporters, people like me and people from other unions, United Auto Workers, steel workers, iron workers, everybody under the sun is blocking the entrance to, or the, well, the exit, actually, to the Mound Road plant so that the Sunday New York, it was on a Saturday, I guess it was, so the Sunday New York Times, or I'm not, the Sunday Detroit News and Free Press could not get out. And then, so across the street, massing are a couple hundred police as well. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. There were hundreds of strikers there and hundreds of police that were brought in from police departments from all over metropolitan Detroit, really. So it really was extraordinary, and, you know, I describe how the police used pepper gas and then ultimately tear gas in ways that really violated the strikers' rights.
Well, you know, one thing you, Chris Romberg, you mentioned clash. Usually I tell people when you see something in the newspaper, demonstrators clash with police, it means that the cops kicked the crap out of some demonstrators wearing flip-flops and shorts, you know. But here you had big, strong, working-class guys, many of whom were neighbors, on both sides of, you know, the line. You know, sometimes in they're all Sterling Heights residents. I mean, sometimes these strikers would be yelling at individual cops, you know, hey, Jim, what the hell are you doing? And, you know, calling them out by name. And in your book, you have the broken table. You very nicely have this description of this pepper spraying and one guy who was just standing there. And I remember him. I saw that. He was wearing only cut-off Levi's shorts and work boots. And the cops had these big foggers, not these little cans like, you know, they use on the Occupy demonstration, but these huge containers of this stuff, and they were spraying it directly on him, and the guy would not move. He was an iron worker, mm-hmm. which did it, yeah.
Yeah, well, there were several lawsuits, of course, that came out of this about police misconduct. Most of those were settled out of court or thrown out, but one of them actually did go to trial and reached a verdict. And in that case, a federal jury found that the city of Sterling Heights, its police officers, and the newspaper agency were actually guilty of conspiracy to deprive the strikers of their civil rights.
Well, having been there, I've got about 1,000 things to say, but you're my guest, and I've already taken up too much time, and we're getting close to the end of my show. So people may wonder, in The Broken Table, your book, The Detroit Newspaper Strike and the State of American Labor, who won?
Well, I don't think anybody won. You know, it was enormously expensive. You can't say the newspapers really won because they dropped an awful lot of money, and the strike went on for 5 years, actually. There was 19 months of strike and then several years of litigation after that. And let me just say this. And the argument I make in the book is that it's a failure of law, that basically the law has been turned upside down. Even though workers have a right to strike in this country, decades of judicial decisions and NLRB precedents have eroded that right. So that, in effect, nowadays we don't really have a right to strike, and I think that's a bad outcome. But if that's a policy decision, that's not something that's written, you know, into the law of nature or anything. It's not because of globalization or technology. It's a policy decision that we have now about, you know, what kind of rights workers have. So that, you know, if we wanted to, we could have different policy. I just want to call attention to this, and that the decline of unionization, I think, has been very harmful for the economy and the society as a whole. But an essential part of that is the decline of workers' rights on the job.
Well, we're almost back to the 1920s, and people ascribe our right to strike and our right to unionize to Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, and that's when it got enshrined into law. But really, what caused it was the incredible militancy of the unionization movement among the rank and file in the beginning of the early 1930s. So the state of American labor today is kind of dismal, isn't it?
We're in bad shape. We are, in effect, in a pre-New Deal era. It's gone that far back, you know. But that's not because of a high-tech economy or anything like that. You know, as I say, one of the interesting things here is that you had white-collar professionals, journalists, who were striking right alongside blue-collar workers. And I think what they saw was that they had just as many issues and concerns about losing autonomy on the job, you know, losing their professional status, that really speak to a lot of the issues that workers in white-collar or information economy types of jobs share the same kinds of issues.
In 60 seconds or less, are you optimistic about the state of American labor as we go forward?
Well, I think it's a big struggle, but I think it's a very important one. What I'm trying to do in the Broken Table is to show that this is an issue that really affects more than just a single group of workers, right? That every strike is not just about a handful of workers at a particular plant or shop, but it's really something that is a public issue that we should all be concerned about, that it affects both the larger economy and our democratic rights. So I'm not trying to bring everybody down with a story of bad news. What I'm trying to do is to show how important it is for us to be concerned about this.
And well done. Chris Romberg has been my guest. His book is The Broken Table, The Detroit Newspaper Strike and the State of American Labor. It's published by the Russell Sage Foundation. You go to russellsage.org to my site, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Chris Romberg, thanks for your book.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. Thanks for rocking with the Riff online. This is WRIF.com.
Do you need cash right now for any reason? Then you need Matt's Jewelry Brokers. At Matt's, they pay top dollar for your used or broken gold, silver, and platinum jewelry, class rings, belt buckles, coins, flatware, and more. It's really that easy. Stop into one of Matt's 5 locations with your items and walk out with cold, hard cash.
Hi, I'm Matt. We've been family-owned and operated for 30 years and pride ourselves on honesty, integrity, and paying more than the superstores do for your broken or used items just lying around the house. If it's collecting dust, we'll buy it. If it's broken, we'll buy it. If you don't want it, we'll buy it. So before you go anywhere else, stop by one of my 5 locations. In Macomb at 21 Mile and Romeo Plank, in Troy at Square Lake and Rochester Road, or my pawn shop in Southfield at 10 Mile and Greenfield. We're also in the Meyer in Clinton Township and Lenox. Check us out online at MattsJewelryBrokers.com or call us at 586-286-2866. That's 586-286-2866. When you need cash fast, go to Matt's.
Reasons why you might need cash right away. Man, those reasons always seem to come right out of the woodwork, don't they? How about reason number 76? Your company's summer gathering, and the little lady's pretty insistent that she's not going unless you buy her that strappy little number she wants. Well, how do you say no to that? No worries. Just stop in any neighborhood check-in gold location with your unwanted gold, silver, or precious metal and coins, and check-in gold will give you cash on the spot. Seriously, what else can you do? Borrow from your mom and dad? Borrow from friends? Get a loan from the bank? Have fun making that happen. Skip the grief and get the cash, not questions, with Check and Gold. They know there's a lot that can turn your budget upside down, so what have you got lying around? Gold, silver, diamonds, coins? Cash them in at any of Check and Gold's 11 suburban locations. Find them online at checkandgold.com. That's check, the letter N, gold.com, or call 800-574-GOLD.
Detroit's Rock Station, on the web. Thanks for listening to WRIF.com.
Yeah.
all of Drew and Mike's best moments delivered right to your computer or mobile device. The Drew and Mike Podcast, brought to you by Matt's Jewelry Brokers. For fast cash, call Matt's at 586-286-2866. Subscribe today at WRIF.com. Getting you back to the rock.
Don't you tell me you died alive.
101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Chance to take a ride on the wild side with Motley Crue's Tommy Lee, September 5th. Get all the details online at WRIF.com.